Their whole purpose throughout history has been to teach a small number of people how to become adept at controlling everyone else and presenting their societies as desirable to the profane, so that you'll go knock on the door and say, "Hey, can I be a member and be initiated?" With the promise of learning some great secret. What is that secret? The secret is what I have just told you this morning. The secret is how to control everybody else. And you never understand how to control everybody else until you get to the top of this pyramid of initiation. Most people never make it past the third step. All above that are carefully chosen and nurtured and taught. And Americans, for all these years, have been looking around for the enemy. They've never been able to find an enemy. So those who control them were able to control them even better by giving them an enemy.
It's Friday. It's 5 past 5. Sorry for the little technical delay there, folks. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, Lord Sumption this week on why the lockdowns are unlawful. He calls it a police state. And that is what we decided not to tell you tonight. The hashtag, film your COVID testing centre, goes wild and produces results the mass media, with all their billions, seems incapable or unwilling to. And Ukraine, they pass new pro-corruption laws. Can you believe that? Mass demonstrations in Kiev again. In Thailand, efforts to remove the monarchy, will they come to nothing? And in Nigeria, Amnesty confirms the army shot to kill unarmed demonstrators 3 weeks ago and then tried to cover it up. And China, censorship. Social credit means categorising all citizens into obedient and disobedient, where the Chinese Communist Party has total power, if it wants, over everyone's lives. The police state and no religious freedom whatever. Only pliable Catholic bishops are chosen by the Chinese Communist Party, and a million Muslims are in internment camps. Well, appropriate then, isn't it? Halloween tomorrow. What is Halloween? But more importantly, what is the Halloween memo? We go back to the 1990s to look at Bill Gates and his attempt to crush any opposition to his little monopolistic project called Microsoft. Finally, it's the final Friday of Black History Month. A double whammy tonight from Malcolm X on the CIA plans to assassinate him shortly before he died. And more recently, another martyr, Colonel Gaddafi, explaining his vision for the repatriation of Africa's stolen wealth before the United Nations General Assembly in September 2009, 2 years before he was executed with a bayonet up his backside. And the Kabbalah. David Livingston on how this diabolical perversion of the Jewish religion, which Madonna and many other celebrities subscribe to, actually promotes a man-god along the lines of Adolf Hitler. So, Martin, that's part two. But part one this week, the main topic, I think, of conversation has got to be what's been going on in the Labour Party and the sensational suspension of Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously major news for Labour Party members. And I imagine lots of our audience will have been following this fairly closely, so I don't need to repeat myself and explain it all to them.
Well, can you just explain your view, what's happened here?
Well, there have been the various people who were not happy with the party's stance on anti-Semitism basically took the party to the Equal Opportunities Commission, I can't remember what it's called.
EHRC.
The EHRC, which is a government body.
Equality and Human Rights.
Yeah, it's a government body which takes over from things like the Commission for Racial Equality, etc. The reports come out, some of the allegations have been supposedly vindicated by the report, although I think people need to read the report carefully.
Very few people are going to bother to do that.
I think it's worth reading carefully. I was on the website for Jewish Voice for Labour last night, and they said, "Well, we'll read this very carefully." the Labour leadership have said, well, we're going to fulfil all the recommendations in full, etc., etc. This is a legal text. Now that is actually, you know, there may actually be further ramifications to that. Jeremy Corbyn commented that that anti-Semitism allegations have been exaggerated. He doesn't claim that there is no anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Nobody would claim that. But he's saying it's been exaggerated for political reasons. And that, of course, then led Starmer to say that he was in some way trying to diss the report, and therefore he's suspended him.
Well, actually, Starmer has distanced himself from the decision, hasn't he? He said, oh, actually, this is just a Labour Party decision. It's not actually my decision. And he's not really commenting on the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, well, I think the people who did make the decision are full-time officials who are answerable to Starmer. So
the Labour Party are going round in circles, aren't they? And the actual only real opposition to Boris seems to be from within the Tory party these days.
Well, the Labour Party's got its own travails, as you know. And, they are the official opposition, but they didn't bother to oppose either the Spy Cops Bill or the military bill that allows military overseas a free hand. But of course the SNP, Liberal Democrats and Greens, Plaid Cymru had no problem opposing that. So I think Starmer has got himself into a bit of a pickle here. And the Labour Party as a whole is not a happy bunny this evening as we speak.
We're going to be hearing a little bit more about this from, well, there's actually a guy called Ken Ferrer who's just brought out a film called Ultra Violence. I can remember way back, gosh, must have been in the early noughties, helping him get a screening of his previous film on at the Eastern Community Centre, which there was enormous pressure to stop it being shown there. And that was called Injustice, Martin, about deaths in custody. This new film, which we'll be talking about in a little while, is called Ultra Violence. It's about deaths outside custody, things like the execution of Jean-Charles de Menezes, as some would say it was an accidental thing, and the fact that those involved in these sorts of things don't get prosecuted. But anyway, let's have a listen to, staying on the subject of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, do you think there is anti-Semitism in the Labour Party still?
Nobody is claiming that there is no anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, but there's plenty of anti-Semitism outside the Labour Party which hasn't been picked up on. And I'm so seriously worried about criticisms of Israel being conflated with anti-Semitism.
OK, well, let's see what Keir Starmer had to say.
To Jewish people, our Jewish members, our long-standing Jewish affiliate, JLM, to the people driven out of our party, the Jewish members driven out of Parliament, including Louise Ellman and Luciana Berger, and to the members of the Labour Party staff who spoke out, I want to say this. I know how hard these last few years have been for you, how painful today will be, and how hard you had to fight to have your voices heard. So let me be clear. I hear you. And I can promise you this. I will act. Never again will Labour let you down. Never again will we fail to tackle anti-Semitism. And never again will we lose your trust. The Labour Party I lead accepts this report in full and without qualification. We will implement all recommendations and we will implement them in full. That process starts today. I've already instructed my staff to start work with the Commission to implement the recommendations at the earliest possible opportunity. We will provide the Commission with our action plan to achieve all of this within 6 weeks. We will establish an independent complaints process, and it will be in place as soon as possible in the new year. We will ensure that neither the leader, the deputy leader, or our offices will have any involvement in the outcome of complaints initiated under the Labour Party processes. And we are already addressing the backlog of anti-Semitism cases. In fact, there have been more cases completed in the last 6 months than in the whole of 2019. But we will go much further, and we must go further, because, as the report makes clear, this cannot be solved just by changing the party's processes and structures. We also need a culture change in the Labour Party. It must become, once again, an open and welcoming place for people from all backgrounds and all communities. Under my leadership, zero tolerance of anti-Semitism will mean precisely that. If you're anti-Semitic, you should be nowhere near this party, and we'll make sure you're not. And if, after all the pain, all the grief, and all the evidence in this report, there are still those who think there's no problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, that it's all exaggerated or a factional attack, then frankly, you are part of the problem too. And you should be nowhere near the Labour Party either.
So this Keir Starmer giving his view yesterday about the idea of this report being implemented. I mean, this is amazing, really, Martin. What he's saying here is that the Labour Party will no longer take any interest itself in deciding on any complaints against Labour Party members. It's going to be an outside independent body that will do so.
Well, I think that I'm not quite sure that is what he said, actually. It'll be interesting to see what he actually means by that. What he's saying is that the leader's office won't have anything to do with it. And of course, I think the quid pro quo for all of this is if people are wrongly accused of anti-Semitism, they should also have redress. And because it is a very, very serious, it's a very serious matter. And therefore, those who make frivolous allegations of anti-Semitism and basically undermine those who are opposed to anti-Semitism by making frivolous allegations, they should also
Jeremy Corbyn has done at least two things. I mean, first of all, he has gone against what Keir Starmer has said there, is he doesn't want people to belittle this, and Jeremy Corbyn immediately did belittle it. And he's also endorsed the cartoons from East London, which show characterised hook-nosed Jewish people in some sort of world conspiracy. So, I mean, it does look as if he's definitely crossed the line on both of those issues.
Well, let's deal with the cartoon first. It was actually a mural. Jeremy Corbyn's position, as I understand, is that he didn't realise that it was an anti-Semitic cartoon, and actually the guy who painted it said there was no intention. He actually named the people in the cartoon, and some of them are Jewish and some of them aren't. So in any case, we could go back over that if people want to. Jeremy Corbyn has basically said that there has been political factionalism surrounding this question. And I would just mention, because it's an actual fact, that the Al Jazeera sting on Shai Moffat and Joan Ryan showed that the Israeli embassy were interfering in internal Labour Party procedures in order to try and conflate anti-Semitism with criticism of the state of Israel. Now, the international definition of anti-Semitism, which has been adopted by the Labour Party with some modifications, the Tories are pushing for that to be adopted by all universities. Most universities have refused to adopt the definition because in actual fact it's subject to legal challenge on grounds of human rights, that is to say, right to free speech. And the Tories, if people challenge it in the courts, it's quite likely that it will not stand. Now, the Labour Party is not actually a public organisation, so they could, in fact, have any rules they like internally about what you can and can't say, and they can expel people if they wish. But the whole thing of having the Equality Commission intervening in this is the idea that all political organisations should be open to anybody to join, even if they are totally out of line with the policies of the organisation.
Yes, but I think the protected category, being Jewish or Muslim, is a protected category. They don't want people who are racist against or anti-religious against those people.
Okay, well, I mean, the British National Party were also challenged with exactly that because they were saying that we're only going to have white candidates. Fair enough. But I think there is a major problem with things like universities because they are public bodies and they are bound by, I mean, political parties can have their own internal rules. I mean, you may agree or disagree with them, but political parties have got their own rules. But public bodies have got to actually abide by the law. And the problem with this definition of anti-Semitism, which has been absorbed into the Labour Party constitution, is that it hasn't got any legal basis. And the legal opinion is that it's not enforceable in the courts.
Well, whether Jeremy Corbyn thought this was a Jewish cartoon, an anti-Jewish cartoon, really rests on the sizes of the noses of the people sitting around the table playing a game in the cartoon, doesn't it? I mean, it does seem a little bit strange that this kind of thing is... I mean, if you look at the cartoon, half of the people around the sitting around the table seem to have maybe potentially Jewish characteristics and the other half not. So,
well, the guy who actually painted it said... he named individuals. He said one of them's Rockefeller, one of them's J.P. Morgan, who's not Jewish, and so on. Yeah. So, in other words, the person who painted it said that it wasn't intended to. I mean, it's undoubtedly
I'll tell you what
I'll
do on our show page. Yeah? At the risk of being accused of being anti-Semitic, I'll let you, dear listener, decide if you want to go and have a look at this cartoon on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It certainly looks to me as if it may have some very mild direction towards anti-Semitism, but it doesn't look like it's an anti-Jewish cartoon. It looks to me as if it's having a go at the oligarchs.
Yes, that's what the guy who painted it said. Any case, Jeremy Corbyn has said, well, if people think it's anti-Semitic, I'm sorry I retweeted it or whatever. But, of course, we've had all this fuss in France this week about whether people can make cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. And, of course, I'm sure Keir Starmer would be in favour of people being able to make cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and opposed to those who kill people associated with such cartoons. So freedom of speech is absolutely sacrosanct in France, but not inside the Labour Party when it concerns anti-Semitism.
Okay, so let's have a listen to what Jeremy Corbyn had to say about this. Martin, do you think he gave a good response?
Well, I think it's very difficult.
Well, let's hear him first. Yeah, let's hear him.
One anti-Semite in the party is one anti-Semite too many. And when I became leader of the party, some complaints were received. I asked Shami Chakrabarti to undertake a review of all this, which she did. She made a number of recommendations on processes which were not implemented quickly enough. Under Jenny Formby's period as General Secretary in 2018, much more progress was made very quickly. But the numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3%. of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party. I did everything I could to make sure a process was put in place and cases were dealt with quickly. And as the report acknowledges, in the latter stages, the process had speeded up, more cases were dealt with, where necessary, people were expelled from the party. But also, I think we could and should have made more progress on the education process, because I do think education into the hurt caused to Jewish people by allegations of anti-Semitism, by anti-Semitic tropes and tweets and messages, is deep and horrible, and I'm very sorry for any people that were hurt as a result of that, because I want to see, like everybody else does in the Labour Party, anti-Semitism completely ended. What I said today was that anti-Semitism is unacceptable in any form. What I said was...
You told me it was exaggerated.
I said the number...
It was drastically overstated.
What I said was the numbers of cases in the public perception had become overstated. The existence of the problem I fully acknowledge, which is why I took action to end the problem in the party by introducing a process to get anti-Semites out of the party. No, I'm not part of the problem. The problem is anti-Semitism historically, anti-Semitism in the present, and the fear that many people have of being under attack at their synagogue, or indeed mosques, temples, and lots of other places within our society. We need to tackle racism in every conceivable form within our society.
So that's the statement that got Jeremy Corbyn removed. Sorry, well, not removed, suspended, Martin, which means he can't partake in party decisions anymore. Do you think that's going to be it now, and he's just going to be suspended, or is he going to go through a process?
Well, there's going to be some kind of internal procedure to decide whether the suspension stands. and what, you know, if it's going to stand, what it will lead to.
But it's very clear,
and so
he
on.
Is part of the problem, according to the current leadership of the party. People like him, who are saying, actually, the whole thing's been exaggerated, are just not going to be tolerated anymore.
Well, that's what they are saying, and of course Starmer immediately jumped up, or rather party apparatchiks immediately jumped up and suspended Corbyn. This could lead to a split in the Labour Party, it's quite possible. I'm not saying it will, I'm just saying it could.
Okay, so, well, actually, Starmer today was saying that the party must stay together through this, and even though it seems like it's him that's kind of trying to cause a split. But anyway, I would just put to you, Martin, another aspect to all of this, and that is that we've been commenting on this programme, ever since we started back in 2008, in the good old Bristol Community Radio days with Phil and Joe running the station, when it was a proper community radio station, that where all views were listened to rather than only some, part of a clique. So the situation in the Middle East has been getting worse and worse. We've been moving towards some sort of conflict between Iran and Israel. And I think that the powers that be are getting a bit nervous about that conflict. They're not necessarily sure that they could win such a conflict. And so they're trying to do everything they can to control organisations that might be a threat to them on the domestic front. And the Labour Party is one of them.
As we know, because of the Al Jazeera television programme, The Lobby, the Israeli embassy were very, very interested in steering Labour policy. And that Shai Moffat said to then Labour MP Joan Ryan, of course she's now resigned from the party, he said, we've got £1 million to spend so that you can set up a youth organisation inside the Labour Party. We've got £1 million to spend so you can take people to Israel on trips. So in other words, they're basically very, very interested in trying to steer Labour Party policy to the tune of £1 million, which of course is US taxpayer money because the Israeli state is dependent on that.
This is the fascinating thing I find about the banksters, is that their power is almost like a feudal power. They can determine say for example they see somebody operating in a small business somewhere that they don't like, that's speaking out, or maybe in a media organisation that's criticising banksters or the Israel lobby or any powerful organisation. That once they've identified them, they can then contact the people who take the money for that organisation, and they can threaten them if they have some sort of clout and leverage with them, as many do. For example, the media relies massively on advertising, and so the advertisers can threaten to say, well, if you continue to support this specific individual, then we will just simply remove our funding. So in a way, this system of capitalism we've got now really is a feudal system, because people, individuals at the bottom end and even in the middle of that system, have very little power. They're all reliant on the people at the top.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't call it feudalism. It's basically the capitalist system. It depends on money, and money talks. And the people with them, and if you've got money and resources, you can control narratives and you can squeeze out voices you don't want to
hear.
And
it's also threats, isn't it? So you just phone up someone and say, look, if you don't get rid of this person, you're not, you know, whatever sort of threat. This is a kind of mafia tactic.
Well, I mean, I think the fear on the left of the Labour Party is that this is going to be used as a means to purge people who are not in tune with the current leadership.
Isn't that bound to cause a split, though?
Well, not necessarily. The problem for the Labour Party, Tony, is under first past the post, and I've been pushing to change this for years.
You're not going to change it. Look,
well, in that case, we've got to keep fighting inside the Labour Party.
We have to look at things as they are. Yeah.
Yes. Well, as they are, there's no way that a split can happen in that sense, because neither side can win without the other. If Starmer thinks he's going to win a general election without the support of Unite, Unison, and the left of the Labour Party, he's deluding himself. If there was a genuine split, that would split the Labour vote, which means we've got no chance. It's only a very, very limited chance we've got anyway. And if the Labour Party split, then it's zero chance to change the government.
The people like the Greens are rubbing their hands watching all this, aren't they?
Well,
thinking that many of those Labour voters may turn
to
them.
I mean, in Bristol, it's quite possible that if there is a big bust-up in the Labour Party, lots of people will vote Green in Bristol West. And you might even, at the very outside, get a Green MP. But that, of course, will change nothing in terms of the national system, which basically is rigged in favour of the Tory party. It was set up by the Tory party in the 18th century, and it's been, and just like the US system is set up to keep the oligarchy in power.
Okay, well, just
so
like
that's what it is.
Just like Jeremy Corbyn was suspended, also suspended was the MP for Derby, Chris Williamson. That was a few years ago. Obviously, Ken Livingstone is another one that's been kicked out of the Labour Party for alleged anti-Semitism.
Yes, and interestingly enough, Ken Livingstone's comments are being used in this report as evidence for the Labour Party's anti-Semitism. Now, in actual fact, what Ken Livingstone was saying is just what I've been saying, is that the Israeli embassy has stuck its finger in here, which I think is overwhelming. I mean, how can anybody deny? We've got somebody on the record saying that's exactly what was going on. So Ken Livingstone has been quoted as one of the there's two.
Yeah, they were secretly recorded, weren't they, by Al Jazeera?
That's right. And in this report, there are only two unlawful acts, and one of them is Ken Livingstone's remark about how the Israeli embassy were sticking their finger in, and that is regarded as threatening and harassing Jewish members of the party. Now, two things about that. A, Ken Livingstone is no longer a member of the party, so that doesn't really stack up. And B, all he was saying is what I'm saying here now, and we've got the evidence. The Israeli embassy is definitely interested in trying to make anti-Semitism, call anti-Semitism anybody who attacks the state of Israel. And that includes the right of the state of Israel to exist. Now, in actual fact, that's a political question. Britain in 1948 finally decided under US and Soviet pressure to recognise the state of Israel.
Martin,
but that was a political decision.
Martin, that was a long, long time ago. Are you saying that if you state that the state of Israel should not have a right to exist, that that's not anti-Semitic?
It's not anti-Semitic. That's a political point. Now, in actual fact, neither Hamas nor Fatah, who are the representatives of the Palestinian people, and don't forget Hamas won the last election in Palestine, neither of them will recognise the state of Israel because the state of Israel won't recognise them. They're under no obligation to recognise the state of Israel. It's not anti-Semitic of them to say we're not recognising it. Why would they recognise it? And, of course, that is just a political position.
Well, the reason that Ken Livingstone was removed from the Labour Party was because he allegedly said that Hitler was a Zionist. Well, he didn't actually say
that. No, he didn't say
that. In fact, I remember phoning up a large international news organisation who had a headline saying that Ken Livingstone had said Hitler was a Zionist. And then within a few minutes, I'd noticed that the headline had changed to the correct. It's amazing how people just... I mean, these are like Chinese rumours. They get all wrong. What Ken Livingstone actually did say was that Hitler supported Zionism, and he certainly did during the agreements which were made, something called the transfer agreement, in the 1920s, actually, very early on, where he was saying that he didn't like Jews, as everybody knows, and he was saying, well, actually, let's have some sort of agreement whereby they can go over to what is now the state of Israel.
Yes, and in actual fact, there was a scoping mission sent with an SS colonel and a senior Zionist, and they went over to scope out the possibility of the Jews going to live in Israel. And of course, at that stage, they both had a shared objective. And in fact, most mainstream Jewish organizations, you've got to remember, Zionism was actually a minority ideology amongst Jews all over the world. They didn't really represent anybody other than themselves. And most Jewish organizations boycotted the Hitler regime completely. The ones that didn't were the Zionists. And that is actually on the record again. It's historical fact.
Another thing which is historical fact is the involvement of the English branch of the Rothschild family in Zionism. And actually, what we now say, what has actually produced, is Martin now a racist state. So does it hold any water, this idea that if you criticise the Rothschilds, you're anti-Semitic?
I think that's absurd. The Rothschilds have been extraordinarily powerful over many generations, and they've basically been involved in all sorts of political events, including the creation of the State of Israel. I think it's absurd to suggest otherwise. That doesn't mean that everybody, it's a big family, that doesn't mean that everybody in the Rothschild family supports the State of Israel.
Well, in the British family, we had two particularly, yeah, didn't we? We had Walter Rothschild, back around the time of the First World War, responsible for drafting the Balfour Declaration, which led to the British Empire basically taking on, as it was at the time, this whole idea of creating a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. And then there was Victor Victor Rothschild. I remember, I don't know if you ever read this book, Martin, back in the 1990s, a book called The Fifth Man by Roland Perry, the Australian journalist, a fantastic tome looking at Victor Rothschild's role right the way through World War II as an atom spy, giving the atomic secrets to Stalin before Churchill knew what was going on. Stalin had heard it from Victor Rothschild. And the most importantly, I suppose, using that cachet with Stalin and the Russian and the Soviet regime in order to get what he wanted from them in Israel, because there were some factions in Soviet Russia which were very against the formation of the State of Israel. Victor Rothschild used leverage that he had, having handed them the atomic bomb, basically, in order to make sure that they supported it.
Yeah, I mean, and the State of Israel is like any other state. It comes into being because people recognise it or don't recognise it. You know, some countries will recognise Kosovo as an independent state now. Some won't because they don't want to accept the precedent. Should Kashmir be an independent state? These are political questions.
And the other fascinating thing about a lot of this is that many of the people being criticised may be Jewish, obviously, but they're secular Jews. They're not really interested in the faith, in the religion, in the Old Testament. And this also is a bit of a difficult thing, isn't it? When you talk about someone as Jewish, is that a racial thing or is it a religious thing?
Well, it's confusing, isn't it? It's essentially a religious category, but people can, in theory, convert to Judaism. But in practice, it's also an ethnic category. And, you know, there are many secular Jews who don't have any religious beliefs at all. And the State of Israel is essentially a political project by the Zionists. And the Zionists do not speak for all Jews. They never did, and they still don't.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to Chris Williamson, the former Derby MP who was removed from the Labour Party for alleged anti-Semitism. This is his response to Jeremy Corbyn yesterday being suspended from the Labour Party over this issue.
This report should never have been commissioned in the first place. And it's important to understand the function it serves. The Commission launched its investigation because of endless lobbying by two anti-Corbyn and pro-Israel outfits, the self-appointed Jewish Labour Movement and the self-styled Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. It was a clear attempt by Zionists and other racists to weaponise anti-Semitism, to criminalise anti-Zionists and left-wing Jews. And they've secured the number one scalp they were after. Jeremy Corbyn's suspension from the Labour Party is a travesty and proof positive that this whole charade was nothing whatsoever to do with anti-Semitism. It was always about destroying socialist pro-Palestinian voices who advocated for a truly internationalist, anti-imperialist ethical foreign policy. A policy that promoted peace and disarmament instead of war and arms sales. And despite what the party said, it's important to highlight that Jeremy's suspension is in no way related to the comments he made today. The truth is, Keir Starmer's discredited Labour Party has been planning to suspend Jeremy for months. So now is the time to fight back, to draw a line in the sand. Remember, we are many, they are few. With our collective strength, we will prevail, because together, anything is possible. Solidarity.
Well, Chris Williamson, of course, has already been expelled from the Labour Party, and the Labour Party leadership are basically saying that anybody that talks in the way that he's talking is part of the problem and not part of the solution. And I think that if they're going to take this kind of radical position, then there's going to be further conflict about this going forward.
I mean, he seems to be saying there what I was saying, which is this really is the home front for the struggle in Gaza, where this is, the idea here is for the Israel lobby to really control debate in Britain about what happens over in Palestine.
Yeah, I mean, the main goal of all of this is to make sure that anybody who criticises the State of Israel, for example, the existence of the State of Israel or the policies of the State of Israel, is anti-Semitic. And that is actually written into this definition, which has been absorbed into the Labour Party constitution with caveats. Now, I think the real issue here, as we go forward, with Jerusalem having been recognised as the capital of Israel by the Americans and nobody else, with continued occupation and oppression in Gaza and in the West Bank, and with millions of Palestinian refugees still stateless in neighbouring countries, as we move towards a major Middle East war, we're going to see whether Keir Starmer is really an anti-Semite or not, or whatever his position is going to be, because the Israeli state has adopted a racist constitution. So they are clearly establishing themselves as anti-Palestinian, one could say Islamophobic. Now, I want to hear clear statements from Starmer about the illegality of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land.
I mean, the other angle to this is there now free speech within the Labour Party, or is that the end of it?
Well, there may or may not be. We are going to find out. I've got to point out that, in actual fact, political parties don't have to guarantee anybody freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is a wider issue. Political parties can say, we don't like your point of view, you're out, as long as they've got, you know, that's what happens all the time. But the point about the definition of anti-Semitism adopted in the Labour Party constitution is that if it was not a political party, if it was a public organisation like a university, that cannot be, it's not legal. It's not legal to say to people that you can't say the state of Israel shouldn't exist. It's not legal that you can say that to people. The Labour Party could decide that we're going to kick people out if they say that the State of Israel shouldn't exist. But the point is that the State of Israel's existence or non-existence is a political question, and it cannot be, universities in particular, cannot say that people who say that are to be given no platform.
Meanwhile, there's been another killing in France this week by an alleged Islamist, somebody who is, I mean, I don't know quite to what extent that person who was killed has been, or the people injured were, actually associated with anything to do with French cartoons against Islam. But look, I mean, the thing is that, Martin, this is having ramifications around the world now, in Turkey particularly, and in Pakistan. Islamabad has summoned the French ambassador in Pakistan to issue a rebuke against the French president's recent comments regarding Islam. So this is, you know, starting to become a little bit of a bigger issue. Do you think Macron has kind of overplayed his hand here?
Right, well, let's just put to bed the Labour Party and anti-Semitism for a minute and move on to this other big topic. You know, it's fascinating, isn't it, that people aren't allowed to say things like the State of Israel shouldn't exist.
But what Macron is saying is that people should have the right to blaspheme.
Yes, that is exactly what he's saying. And they are basically saying, I mean, the teacher who brought these cartoons up in a class, they were discussing freedom of speech. And before he even brought the cartoons up, he said, if you're unhappy with seeing these cartoons, you can leave before we begin to discuss it. And so on. So he was basically problematizing the cartoons. He wasn't pushing them. He was saying, look, these are the cartoons. What do you think? Should they be allowed to?
I mean, you could say, in a way, a little bit like we just did by saying, here's the supposed anti-Jewish cartoon and you can have a look at it on our show page.
Indeed. That's right. Now, these bring up fundamental questions about freedom of speech and so on, don't they? In principle, people should be allowed to say what they want. You've got the right to offend people, but whether you should always exercise it is another matter.
Another thing, of course, is this is taking place in the context of school, very impressionable young minds, do you think that's a legitimate aspect to teaching?
Well,
because the French government has said this week that the problem is there's an ideology which claims its own laws should be superior to those of the Republic. And I think I'm right in saying that most religions believe that their laws should be superior to those around them, don't they?
No.
No?
No. I think that's an exaggeration. I think basically most Muslims are genuinely offended by the cartoons, but most of them realise that they can't stop the cartoons, and there's no point, and certainly they shouldn't go and kill people at random because of cartoons.
So maybe the only country in the world that those cartoons might actually be illegal is somewhere like Iran, which is an
Saudi
Islamic
Arabia.
Republic. Oh, in Saudi Arabia too.
Yeah, our allies.
You might get beheaded for...
Well, you can't. There's no Christian churches in Saudi Arabia at all. And, of course, they are our allies in the war against Yemen, etc.
So this is a bigger thing going on here with the former French colonies, isn't there? Places like Algeria, etc. There's lots and lots of Islamic people in France.
Yeah, well, in 1998, there was a bombing in the metro in Paris, which killed a number of people. And it was claimed that it was carried out by the GIA, the Groupe Islamique Armée, which is the military wing of the FIS, the Front Islamique Salvation. And it turned out that the bombing was actually carried out by the Algerian security forces with the connivance of the French state in order to blacken Islam, or rather to blacken the political opposition inside Algeria, which were engaged in an armed struggle against the military regime. And in actual fact, both France and Britain and the US have got a massive history of working very closely with Islamist groups, which they fund and direct at second hand with their Saudi allies, in order to create a bad image of Islam. And that, I'm afraid the evidence for this goes back decades, back to the 1980s, an Operation Cyclone, when an Islamic International Brigade was recruited from all over the Middle East to go and fight in Afghanistan against the Soviets. And the Western intelligence services were in it up to their eyeballs. And of course, our allies, the Saudis, there's a report that was commissioned by the British government, when the Liberal Democrats were in coalition, to say who is actually funding Islamic extremism in Britain. And what we believe that report says, although we've not been allowed to see it, is that it points the finger directly at Saudi Arabia, our major allies, who provide thousands of jobs in Britain, producing arms for the Saudi regime. And the Saudi regime's Wahhabi ideology is Islamism. That's what it is. And we have been in bed with these people for years and years and years and years and years. And they are now in bed with the Israelis. And so there's actually a front of extremism here. The extreme right in Israel is aligned with the extreme Islamist right in Saudi Arabia, which is aligned with the Western intelligence services. And, of course, what they're all doing is trying to make Islam the enemy. And, of course, the answer for ordinary people about this is we're not going to have any kind of enemies. Not Jewish enemies, not Islamic enemies.
Yeah, the idea,
we're going to work together.
I mean, as I say, sometimes it's hardening the sides. It's getting you to choose sides.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the World Zionist Organization, Alison Weir, has written an article this week about it. It says there is a World Zionist Congress, and it's meeting right now. She talks about the enormous power of the Zionist lobby, which is very rarely ever mentioned, but it's everywhere. The World Zionist Organization, she says, has been all sorts of... I mean, there's been a World Zionist Congress going for many decades, founded in 1897, the World Zionist Organization. But there is actually lots and lots of other additional Zionist organization. The Women's International Zionist Organization. There's Mizrahi, the Global Religious Zionist Movement. There's the Zionist Organization of America. There's Hasada, the Women's Zionist Organization of America. There's the American Zionist Movement. There's also the World Jewish Congress, which is another international congress that supports Israel. There's also the World Holocaust Forum, another international entity that supports Israel. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. The American Jewish Committee, despite its name, is another international organization that has 30 offices around the world. The Jewish Agency for Israel. There's the B'nai B'rith International, which has been in existence for 175 years. There's Maccabee World Union, headquartered in Israel. There's the Jewish National Fund, which was founded in 1901. The World Union of Progressive Judaism, headquartered in Israel, with 1,200 members and 1.8 million, actually, not, sorry, 1.8 million members in more than 50 countries. And there's a great long list here, but the last one I'll read out is the World Union of Jewish Student Partners. And there's a lot of money behind this. Martin, you were pointing out that much of this actually is US taxpayers' money.
Yeah, well, the State of Israel gets the lion's share of US overseas aid, even though, of course, it's basically a developed society. There's Palestinians live in third world conditions, but that's not the case for Israeli citizens. But they get a massive amount of, they get military support and support for the general budget. So that million pounds that Shai Moffat suggested could be spent.
Shai Massot.
Massot suggested.
And he was the political attaché at the Israeli embassy.
Yeah, and that money ultimately would be basically US taxpayers' money.
I mean, I would say, though, that most political attachés do this sort of thing, don't they? They have a slush fund where they're trying to buy influence in whichever country they are, and this is the Israeli embassy in London.
Yeah, well, he had to flee the country, and the Israeli embassy apologised for what he was doing. But I think when we're talking about people trying to control politics, politics, like the Russians are hacking our elections, which I was just talking about on RT this morning. The Israeli lobby is massive in the United States and in Britain, and they definitely want a pro-Israel policy from either a Labour or a Conservative government. And this Conservative government we've got in this country, many of the leading members are very strongly pro-Zionist and supportive of Israel's positions. That's quite clear. And ultimately, of course, what Keir Starmer is forgetting is that although Ken Livingstone has been removed from the Labour Party, Chris Williamson has been removed, but we've still got, as a member in good standing, Tony Blair, who was accused by the Chilcot inquiry of being a war criminal.
Most of the world have accused him of being a war criminal, actually. He's still walking the streets, you're quite right, not even behind jail, and still...
And still a Labour Party member in good standing.
In the Labour Party, amazing. Anyway, more stuff to do with free speech here. There'll be more about censorship in part two, where we'll be hearing quite a lot of people who have got contributions to make to the argument about COVID-19 and the sort of so-called second wave, people who've been censored to do with that. But at the BBC, Martin, this week they've published the do not express a view edict. I mean, it's really just about the BBC employees. I could call them guidelines, but they're really rather strict rules. If you break them, you could just be out of a job. And one of those rules is that employees must not express a view on any policy which is a matter of current political debate, or on a matter of public policy, political or industrial controversy, or any other controversial subject. And although the BBC, of course, itself is doing this all the time, individual employees, if they do this on social media in future, may get the sack.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously there's a determination by the government to rein in the BBC and prevent it from, people in the BBC having their opinions. I mean, you know, they're obvious targets of people like Gary Lineker, who's a sports commentator but has other views. Most journalists working for other organisations, which are not the BBC, are entitled to have any views they like. And of course, when he worked for the BBC, Jeremy Clarkson was an outspoken and very well paid Tory. But maybe he should be silenced if he was working. I mean, obviously he left the BBC because he started punching people when he lost his temper. And of course, you know, many senior BBC journalists are well known Tories. Maybe they should be told to be quiet as well.
Traditionally, the BBC, although not now, traditionally it was an organisation which encouraged a broad spread of opinion.
Yeah, well, my view would be, we should have a broad spread of people. You know, Laura Kusenberg is not a Labour Party supporter, nor is Robinson, who used to be the head of the Young Conservatives. I've got no problem with them working with the BBC and having those views. But by the same token, I've got no problem with other people working with the BBC having different views. The point is that everybody should be represented by the BBC. You can't get this idea that everybody who works for the BBC has just got to be a sort of non-person with no views about anything. That strikes me as absolutely silly. What you've got to have is a whole spread of views and different people saying different things. That makes much more sense to my mind.
Yes, so also Hugh Edwards has mocked the new impartiality guidelines. He's a BBC newsreader. He was, I believe, the newsreader on 9/11 who was announcing the collapse of Building 7 alongside Jane Stanley, if I remember rightly, Martin. His Twitter handle has got, he's the newsreader, has got a picture of him with a mask on there. And he's quoted it saying the BBC's new social media guidance says the use of emojis can accidentally or deliberately undercut an otherwise impartial post. Well, I mean, first of all, this is implying that the BBC is impartial, which is, yeah, stretching a point. Well, it's a load of rubbish, obviously. But in his tweet, he's put lots of little Welsh flags in there, which are, you know, one of those sort of things you would consider an emoji. So he's kind of sending it up.
Yeah. And of course, if the Tory government gets its way, and prevents the BBC from basically representing a broad spectrum of opinion, then it will, that will be a sad day. And, you know, we'll all be dependent on anybody can say anything. Of course, you know, we've got a print media where total partisanship is completely accepted. And of course, the print media is overwhelmingly pro-Tory. So they then think of the BBC as somehow left-wing because it isn't pro-Tory.
Well, the new Director General, Tim Davey, he throughout this report, he's going on about the BBC brand, as if it's something which is trusted. I think it's not really true to say that it is trusted anymore. But of course, this is the way people who've formerly been directors of communications and senior people at somewhere like PepsiCo selling Coca-Cola or Pepsi Cola, that's the way they think. And that's, of course, what he is. He's a former PepsiCo executive.
Yeah. And I think what the Tory right wing want to do is they want to stop the BBC being independent in its views. I mean, the BBC, as we know, I mean, lots of left wing people think Laura Kusenberg is had it in for Jeremy Corbyn from the get go and didn't mind letting people knowing that that's what her opinion was. But nevertheless, in so far as it does allow other more radical opinions, the Tory right are determined to silence it, because as far as they're concerned, things like Fox News and the Daily Mail are objective journalism and the BBC isn't. We're either going to have some, you know, if you're going to have state-funded media, then there's got to be some obligation on the state-funded media to show all sides of opinion, or we're just going to have a free-for-all where anybody can say what they like. And there's something to be said for that, but no crying for mummies if we start saying things you don't like.
One of the people who is slated for being chair of the BBC is the former culture secretary, Nicky Morgan, which I can hardly believe. One of the most irritating people I've ever seen on screen. But I suppose that's one way you can get them off the screen, is put them on as the chairman of the corporation. But we discussed last week, Martin, didn't we, this chap who's called Richard Sharp. He's the former Goldman Sachs executive who is being slated as a potential BBC chair. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that we were discussing this last week, that there's £20 billion they reckon has gone missing with the COVID loan scheme. So many honest people will be paying back their loans, but £20 billion of that money has just been gifted to organised crime. And Richard Sharp was in charge of that programme for the Treasury. So he's the ex-Goldman Sachs guy who's just given £20 billion or so to organised criminals, and yet he's being slated as an ex-BBC chair.
Well, you also think, well, what's televisual experience has he got? I mean, why don't we put Dido Harding in charge of the BBC and have done with it? I mean, this is absurd, really. You'd have thought that the BBC ought to be run by people who knew something about television, wouldn't you?
So I actually think my favourite would be Bill Oddie. I think, you know, he's one of those people like Spike Milligan who actually made everybody laugh and is a genuine person. I'm not expecting Bill to get the job, but, you know, people who the BBC have sidelined over the years seem to be the people who should be running it now. That's my take on all of this. Anyway, Richard Sharp, one of his jobs was a part of the Bank of England as the deputy governor under Mark Carney. So obviously a very powerful position there. But I thought we'd have a little listen to him. This is where he comes from, Martin. He's someone who's very, very interested in banking regulation, something which, of course, now we've seen with the bailouts in 2008, and also with the potential collapse of the banks earlier last September, the banking regulation is obviously an absolute dog's breakfast, but it turns out that he's an absolute guru when all this is concerned. So Goldman Sachs private company doing the regulation, and here he is. I just thought it'd be interesting to see where he's coming from. Let's get a tune of who is this guy, because here he talks about the way that financial policy and regulation is actually working or not working, is the subtext to it, of course, because he talks it all up, makes out it's all wonderful, and of course it isn't. So here's Richard Sharp now, who's being slated as a potential BBC chair.
The statutory objectives of the FPC are twofold. First, to contribute to the achievement of the Bank of England's financial stability objective, and second, subject to that, to support the economic policy of Her Majesty's government, including its objectives for growth and employment. The FPC has powers, considerable powers, to give directions to the PRA and the FCA in relation to the use of certain specified macroprudential instruments, which are currently the sectoral capital requirements and countercyclical capital buffer. It can make recommendations to anybody, including the PRA and the FCA, on a comply or explain basis. And it is able to make recommendations to HM Treasury, including on the boundaries within and around the perimeter of the PRA and the FCA regulatory regimes. The FPC's tools will form the first line of defence against financial stability risks. That's what they're there for. This includes financial stability risks that may be indirectly created by the actions of other committees, as the MPC itself recognised in its use of forward guidance. And when using its tools, the FPC aims to take graduated and proportionate action where possible. The committee has stressed this approach recently, for example, when considering the risks stemming from the housing market. And the set of tools that it can deploy to manage these risks are ones it will do so carefully and gradually as they emerge. In addition to risks like those in the housing market, which vary over the course of the business cycle or credit cycle, the FPC is also responsible for addressing risks that emanate from the structure of financial institutions, financial markets, or the financial system as a whole. And as these structural risks are broad and varied, the committee has decided to focus over the next 12 to 18 months on three key medium-term priorities: establishing the medium-term capital framework for banks, ending the problem of too big to fail, and ensuring diverse and resilient resource sources and market-based finance.
So that's Richard Sharp there, glittering. I think actually Bill Oddie could probably do a better version than that talk. But Martin, here he is from the Bank of England, essentially the main regulator, one of the individuals who's in charge of regulating banking, the most important people. He's talking about the PRA there, the Prudential Regulation Authority, who are supposed to overlook the auditing companies who we know are absolutely crooked and corrupt, like PricewaterhouseCoopers and KPMG, and also the Financial Conduct Authority, who oversee the banks. Now, the banks are basically doing whatever they want. So isn't it interesting that you've got a Goldman Sachs guy overseeing, essentially regulating his own industry?
Yeah, well, it's what economists call regulatory capture. So it's a kind of revolving door. So the private sector, he's basically been employed in the private sector. That's where he's made his money. Then he goes to work for the Bank of England because, of course, he's the expert now, having been a private sector banker. And, of course, what he's doing there is basically pulling the wool over everybody's eyes that the Bank of England is regulating the banking system.
What is this obsession?
Of course it isn't.
With accountants and money. I mean, the idea that an accountant should run the BBC is just an appalling idea. I can remember chatting to people in the BBC not long after I'd left in 1993, and they said, well, what they've done is all the people who are doing the accounts, because there were a whole load recruited by John Burt to start doing a kind of internal market in the BBC back around about 95, 96, that they were being then retrained as editors and producers. So someone has gone to university, got an accounting degree, and then they've been told, you are going to be a great new producer of the future. Now, these people had no background in the arts whatsoever, and so that might be why we've got this kind of robotic version of the BBC we've got now. But he's also talking there, Martin, about this whole thing of the credit cycle, the business cycle, and managing risk within that. But I mean, certainly the way I've seen it, the traditional business cycle is out the window. What we've seen is just basically a bumping up and down depression or recession.
Well, I mean,
was the last boom anyway?
Well, there's been a recovery from 2008.
So would he say there has been a boom?
It's not a boom, Tony.
What would he say?
What's happened is that there has been, because there's been quantitative easing and zero interest rates for over a decade, the economy hasn't collapsed yet.
Right.
But in actual fact, if you look at the economic
textbook, that's not the same as a boom, is
it? No, it's not. Because in actual fact, a boom, if there was a boom going on, you'd expect interest rates to rise. But of course, they haven't risen, because ultimately, what used to happen was you had crashes and booms, but now we've just got money printing, which in the short run, which can go on for quite a long time, keeps the economy looking as if it's kind of functioning. But in actual fact, it's basically been shot to pieces for over a decade, and at some point it's just going to crash. And then, of course, will be, you know, all sorts of very nasty outcomes will become apparent.
Okay, so let's leave that for the time being and look now at this new film that's out called Ultraviolence. I would imagine it's only going to be shown in somewhere like The Watershed. You have to keep an eye open. That I did have a look around to see if it's being shown in Bristol. Couldn't see anything, but that might just be because I was using Google, and Google doesn't want you to find out anything interesting these days. You know, I generally now have several search engines. I will try the same search in each, and Google is notoriously now the worst for anything that's worth finding. So use other ones, please, and not Bing. Just find something. I don't want to say which one to use. You have to have a whole sort of plethora of these search engines nowadays in order to actually find what you want to find. Because Google, for example, either disappears or completely buries at 200 pages down what you've actually put in the search box these days. But anyway, Ken Farrow was on RT's Going Underground with Afshan Rassani earlier this week, talking about this ultra-violence documentary. Martin, we have seen, haven't we, an enormous change in the law just in the last few weeks, which is going to allow police to commit murder without there being any redress through the courts, which is an absolutely extraordinary thing. I mean, we'll be talking in a little while about Ukraine as well, where they've now said that corruption is fine. Basically, I couldn't quite believe that. I thought that it was a typo, but no, the Ukrainian Parliament have passed pro-corruption laws. And in the UK here, we've had this Covert Sources Act, which is just gone through Parliament now, which enables all these different government agencies to rape and murder without any redress through the courts. Well, one does quite wonder what the courts are for, if that's going to be happening. So what do you make of the way that in Britain, Martin, that we've seen so many deaths? I mean, this is not deaths in custody, which Ken's previous film, Injustice, was all about, but deaths outside custody with no redress for the families.
Well, I haven't seen the film, so I don't know what particular... I mean, you mentioned that John Charles de Menezes is one of the cases that he covers, but of course, from the Irish Republican point of view, is the Force Research Unit of the British Army was essentially directing the loyalist terror campaign for decades, which killed hundreds of people. And I sent you a link this week to Scapatacci, who's Steak Knife, head of the Nutting Squad, the internal IRA internal security office. He was working, and he killed loads of people, was working for the British Army all the time. And he was going to be charged with perjury, but he's now been told that he's not going to have to go to court. Now, in other words, the state has been massively involved in murder and terrorism. But we're not allowed to, you know, we're not allowed to say so in polite
Can
company.
Can we just put this in simpler terms, Martin, which is that the guy who was in charge of deciding at the top of the IRA who in that organisation should live and who should die was working for the British Army?
Yeah. So in other words, and of course they were quite happy for him, basically what he did is he killed loyal IRA members and the traitors were all protected. And that was, you know, the British state's, one of the British state's activities. Pretty and so in other words, I would argue, and of course we've got our suspicions as well about Islamist terrorists being working with the security forces. So for example, the Islamic Fighting Group based in Manchester has been based in Manchester since the early 80s. The Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, a lot of their people were recruited to go and fight in Afghanistan.
Well, back during the time,
and also were used as foot soldiers to overthrow Gaddafi.
Back during the
all working with MI6.
During the time of the 2017 election, you'd have to wonder exactly what the anti-terror hotline was for, because those people who were involved in masterminding the terrorist attacks, the three terrorist attacks, that is to say the Manchester Arena bombing, the London Bridge attack, and also the Westminster Bridge attack, had all in previous months been reported to MI5 as potential terrorists that they should keep a very close eye on. And it almost seems as if that line is actually a terrorist attack recruitment line.
Yeah, well, I think there are serious questions about the behaviour of the security forces in Britain going back decades. And that includes both running the loyalist paramilitary death squads, infiltrating the IRA, so therefore they're co-responsible for a lot of the IRA's atrocities, and of course Islamist terrorists who were all recruited initially in the 1980s to fight in Afghanistan, but then they carried in recent years exactly the same rat lines have been used to infiltrate Islamist extremists into Syria. many of them from Libya, like Abdul Hakim Belhaj, and all of these people have been, you know, their relationship with Western intelligence services is intimate. The Saudis are our allies, and this is what we've been doing for years. And of course, these laws that have been passed now are basically to try and prevent any kind of legal investigation of what the intelligence services and security forces have been up to. And basically, it's a power grab. And it's definitely a slippery slope to a police state.
Okay, so I'll put a link up to the full interview you're about to hear a clip of on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here is Afsan Rachani talking to the director, Ken Farrow. It's been something like 15 years since he brought out his previous documentary, Injustice, about deaths in custody. And his latest one looks to be an absolute must-see. Of course, they will not be showing it on the BBC back in the old... Back up until the 80s, when Victor Rothschild had the Director-General, Alistair Milne, removed as Director-General in 1987, as Marmaduke Hussey says in his autobiography. He makes absolutely clear that was Victor Rothschild's initiative with the backing of Margaret Thatcher. That we won't see this sort of thing. We used to see this sort of thing, but we certainly haven't since around about that time in the late 1980s. But anyway, so here is Ken Farrow, and he also looks at the potential of having a human rights lawyer on the side of those who are victims of police violence.
All the organs of the state, since we've been working on this issue, which is for the past 25 to 30 years, the Police Complaints Authority, the IPCC, the IOPC, these are just letters that change every decade. They have never, ever successfully prosecuted police officers, apart from the one case we reveal in the film for the first time, that of Henry Foley. And I think the fact that we've had over 2,000 deaths in a 50-year period and that these crimes have gone unpunished is a testament to the failure of the state. The states, whether it's a Labour or Conservative government, have run roughshod over human rights of the people of this country. And in the film, we try to explore how that's happened and what can be done about it, because the film is about the victims, but it's also about resistance, about how people fight back and how it's possible to have hope in these very dark times.
Do you think even one current British Member of Parliament, though, would accept that police regulators are designed to promote false confidence in restitution, that they are de facto encouraging violence by having them, that agencies are actually complicit in erasing memory?
They are complicit in erasing memory, and the film tries to make sure that memory is kept alive. And of course it will now. Nothing can ever be hidden away forever, and this film tries to expose that. I think in terms of politicians and the state in general and all these different quangos and NGOs, they're very complicit in what's been going on. Everybody knows what the issue is, but they're too frightened to deal with it. And I think this is something that feeds into the general population. Some MPs have spoken out in terms of deaths in custody in the past, but they haven't looked at it in terms of what it is. Systematic, brutal system which kills people, in some cases of murder, some cases manslaughter, and some cases of unlawful killing. These cases have never actually been seen in the light of day, and what the film tries to do is to question not just the people of the UK, but also to put it out to the world to say, we need help here. We need somebody to come out from the outside. That could be the UN, it could be another body, to actually look at what's happening in this country. Because when we made the film and Injustice beforehand, we did discover that in the United States, police officers actually have gone to jail for the killings of people in their custody. In France, there are several examples where police officers have actually gone to jail. And I can name many countries across the world, in the Middle East, in Africa, and in other European countries and Latin America, where officers have gone to jail for killings in their custody.
Okay, but you're not saying the US has a better justice system than Britain's.
The US, in terms of deaths in custody, has prosecuted police officers. And of course, I'm not going to advocate the US justice system over the system here. They're equally bad.
We now have a human rights lawyer as head of the main opposition party in this country, Sir Keir Starmer. In your film, Ultraviolence, you suggest that Jean-Charles de Menezes was murdered by police, Cressida Dick. Now she's been promoted to head of Britain's largest police force, Scotland Yard. What do you make of Sir Keir Starmer saying that, as regards an appeal by the family, and I know the family are in the film, it was a mistake, it wasn't a murder?
I think it's interesting that you bring up Cressida Dick. I think the message that gives in terms of her involvement in the Jean-Charles de Menezes killing For her to then be promoted to be head of the Metropolitan Police Service gives a very disturbing message. In terms of Keir Starmer, I met with him and with other members of families of people that have been killed by the police. We had a discussion with him, and he absolutely promised he would look into the issue and that he was there to support families. Of course, he did nothing of the sort. And so, historically, Keir Starmer has really not been there for the families, and we don't expect him to be there for the families again. The fundamental issue here is that this country is very well aware of what's going on. This country and this government and previous governments are very, very aware of what's going on, and they refuse to do anything about it. So the people need to do something about it themselves, and I know that the families are organising to try to get external bodies to come into the UK to try and assist them in their struggles for justice.
Well, that's the director, Ken Farrow, there, who did a previous amazing film, Injustice, back in 2001, which looked at deaths in custody, which I can remember we showed back all that time ago, 19 years ago, in Eastern Community Centre. And there were a couple of what looked like plainclothes police in the audience. And there was also an attempt to stop the Eastern Community Centre from showing an attempt at censorship, you know, which obviously is still around today. But Martin, what do you make of the this idea of trying to pull this film together? Is a couple of major points he's making. Number one is that you've got a leader of the opposition who's a major human rights lawyer, but Ken is saying that he's not going to be any help whatsoever because he's made all sorts of promises and he's completely failed on every single count to do with helping the families of these victims of human rights abuses by the British police and anti-terror squads, these kinds of things. And also, well, there's all sorts of aspects there. But the idea of appealing to foreign people to come and help, because we have a horrendous human rights situation in Britain. I think we like when we're growing up in this country, certainly with me in this, you know, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, you're thinking, oh, well, actually, Britain's got a reasonable human rights record. It turns out we haven't.
Yeah, well, the Pat Finucane Centre in Belfast have been saying for years that they want a full inquiry into collusion between loyalist terrorists and the state. But they've qualified that by saying that we don't want a British inquiry, because a British inquiry will simply not be independent. What they're calling for is an international inquiry under the auspices of the UN or something similar to look into what happened. And, of course, this is a big problem that most people in Britain have failed to recognise over many years. The war in Ireland was a war in which the state engaged in all kinds of evil actions, bombings, shootings, assassinations, etc. Now, that doesn't justify evil actions by other people. I'm not suggesting that. But the idea that somehow the state was neutral is simply wrong. It wasn't. It still isn't. And it's a big... and, of course, what's important about this is that the war in Ireland, thankfully, has come to an end. But, of course, the methods are still being used. And a lot of the so-called Islamist terrorism that we are experiencing also has been manipulated by the intelligence services. And what you really need is independent investigation of that. And, of course, what these bills that have been passed in Parliament do is they make it impossible to talk in terms of having independent investigations. So similar people to Sir Keir Starmer, Imposimato in Italy was the head of the Supreme Court, Balthazar Garzon in Spain, who's involved in the Assange case, which we haven't mentioned. And, of course, that is another travesty. Ultimately, the deep state is trying to make sure that it cannot be prosecuted for all of these evil actions. And that is something that we should be very, very aware of. Why are they asking for this kind of immunity? It's because they're up to their eyeballs in promoting terrorism. And that is the honest to God truth.
2,000 people killed over the last 50 years by the police. But only one of those apparently has ever been prosecuted.
Well,
one of those people, but one police officer.
Well, obviously, there's lots of people, you know, you'd have to know what all those different cases are. I mean, we all know that there's a tendency for the establishment to look after its own. That happens not just in Britain, but all over the world.
So we're talking about around about a rate of 40 people a year being killed by the police, and your chances of actually getting the police prosecuted for it, even if they're found innocent, but they're not even going to be prosecuted, is virtually zero.
Yeah, and of course, for many years, people on
isn't this a license to kill? Maybe the police have already got a license to kill.
Well, effectively, they have. And of course, the security forces in Northern Ireland certainly did have. And they were engaged in basically promoting terrorism. And there was investigations by Sir John Stevens of the Metropolitan Police and John Stalker from Greater Manchester Police. They both got basically pointed the finger in the right direction. The state is actually behaving as a terrorist. But nothing has ever done about it. And nobody has ever punished.
I think Ken is one of those absolute ultimate slow burner directors, isn't he? I mean, it's taken him quite a while to put this film together, and it's come out in the middle of a so-called pandemic, or, you know, second wave, so-called, where it's actually very difficult to get it screened anyway and get anybody in, even in the cinema, to watch it. The way he runs his films, Martin, and I rather like this, is the way he will turn up personally at the showing, the screening generally, and they have a showing of it, and quite often one of the family members of someone who was killed there actually at the screening to be involved in a, say, 30-minute, 40-minute discussion after the screening.
Well, yes, and also, of course, we've got the investigation, supposedly, into the spy cop scandal, and
Is there an investigation into that? I thought yes, that ground to a halt.
No, there is supposedly being an investigation. It's just started.
Yeah, because Pitchford, whoever he was, the judge, died.
No, there's somebody else been appointed to do it. But, of course, they were, you know, this is, again, these are illegal acts, unlawful acts. And, you know, the investigation looks as if it's not going to, I mean, people, you know, police officers who are involved in these illegal acts are being allowed to testify without having to identify themselves, which means that the activists that they were targeting can't actually question their testimony. But the state has been involved in all of these things for many, many years.
Well, they're basically
it's not
refused.
A state. It's ultimately it's not a state.
Say something
of laws.
About that inquiry, because I happen to know some of the people involved. I mean, I've submitted evidence to it myself about people involved with the group The Land Is Ours that I was part of, which is an environmental direct action campaign that we believed we were infiltrated by probably at least two people. And that evidence effectively has gone nowhere, because the people who are involved in the inquiry itself have said the police are just refusing to open the files. Now, the judge has said he wants to see all of the files that the police have on all of the groups, and the police have just said, well, this is breaches national security, so we can't show you them. So the whole thing has ground to a halt, effectively, and most of the people involved have stepped away from it until the police do reveal the files, and they're still refusing to. So who polices the police? I suppose this is a question, and it doesn't seem to be this judge.
No, I mean, the pattern is clear. The deep state in Britain, as deep states elsewhere, is beyond the law. And even to the extent of murdering people and creating terrorist incidents, which can then be used to manipulate public opinion, this has been ongoing for years and years and years. And the answer ultimately is proper disinfectant of sunlight and the prosecution of those who carried out illegal acts. And if we're not going to do that, then this isn't a state of laws. It's a state. It's a police state.
It's actually what Zara Sultana talked about a few weeks ago, wasn't it? The descent to tyranny, and this is how this happens. Anyway, we're going to take our weekly look around the world and at coronavirus in a minute, and the various corona stories. Lots to talk about there too. But before that, I thought we'd have a bit of a tribute to my suggestion for chairman of the BBC, Bill Oddie. And we'll have also a bit of music following that, which is from the English Rebel Songs album from Chumbawamba.
Still and wages, shall our house be saved? may the show very mighty.
In a food
may the mighty, yeah. Oh God, God who made thee mighty. Wow! Make thee my champ.
Hey, not in all, get it down, get it down. Ding a ding a dong, with a what? Oh, riddle me. Yeah!
Said vessel to fall.
We're off to the woods, said John the Red Nose.
We're off to the woods, said John the Red Nose.
Oh, what will you do there, said Milda to Malda.
Oh, we may not tell you, said vessel to fall.
We'll shoot the cutty wren, said John the Red Nose.
We'll shoot the cutty wren, said John the Red Nose.
The summer was over, the season unkind. In harvest a snow, how uncommon to find. The times were oppressive, and well be it known that hunger will strongest offences break down. 'Twas then from their cells the black gentry stepped out, with bludgeons determined to stir up a rout. The prince of the party who revelled from home was a terrible fellow and called Irish Tom. He brandished his bludgeon with dexterous skill, and close to his elbow was placed Bally Will. There instantly followed a numerous train, as cheerful as bold Robin Hood's merry men. Sworn to remedy a capital fault, and bring down the exorbitant price of the malt. From Dudley to Walsall they trip it along, and Hampton was truly alarmed at the throng. Women and children wherever they go, shouting out, oh, the brave Dudley boys, oh! With nailers and spinners the cavalcade join, the markets to lower their flattering design. 6 days out of seven poor nailing boys get little else at their meals but potatoes to eat. For bread hard they labour, good things never carve, and swore 'twere as well to be hanged as to starve. Such are the feelings in every land, nothing necessity's call can withstand. And riots are certain to sadden the year, when sixpenny loaves as 3 pounders appear.
Ah. Oh, how will you cut him up, said Milda to Milda.
Oh, we may not tell you, said vessel to fall.
With knives and with forks, said John the Red Nose.
With knives and with forks, said John the Red Nose.
And who'll get the spare rib, said Milda to Milda.
Oh, we may not tell you, said vessel to fall.
We'll give them all to the poor, said John the Red Nose.
We'll give them all to the poor, said John the Red Nose.
Okay, that was the Cutty Wren finishing off that little bit excerpt from the English Rebel songs. 1994, I think that came out. And obviously before that, we had Bill Oddie with Land of Hope and Glory from 20 years before that or so. Now, Martin, in the second hour, I think we're going to, you know, we call second part of the programme. We're not being restrained by hours. We do tend to go on a little bit longer than usual. Sorry, folks, but it does allow us to put a bit more in the programme and cover a bit more. I'm trying to get some of these clips cut down so that we can crack through more material. But we'll start, I think, this week with this whole idea against the idea of civil disobedience against things like curfews. Now, can you explain to me how you can justify having a curfew in a so-called pandemic? I mean, most people would argue that the pandemic is not still happening, that we have a case-demic instead, lots of cases, and many of those cases of people who don't have any symptoms, particularly youngsters. But what about this idea of having a continuing curfew through the Christmas period?
Well, I don't think that's been suggested yet, has it? It may happen. Various measures have been adopted in various parts of the world to deal with this pandemic.
We've certainly got that in France, haven't we, Neil?
Well, it's possible.
They're talking about doing... It's not possible. It's happened in France, mm-hmm. where you actually have to get permission to leave your home.
Yeah, well, there's lots
That's during the daytime.
Yeah, well, that was certainly the case in Cyprus. I know what's going on there. You had to have permission to leave the house, and they stopped people coming into Cyprus. And they've managed to largely control the epidemic there. And they're
This isn't true, is it? This isn't true at all. You say control the epidemic. What happens is as soon as you start to allow people to have normal activities, that's when the contagion then just starts up again.
Well, as long as you haven't got people coming in from outside,
I mean, this is a permanent
that's not the
thing,
case,
isn't it? It's a permanent thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to just stop people going into across borders indefinitely forever now?
Well, you can see that that's the way it's going, Tony. Whether you like it or not, that's clearly what's happening. Air traffic has virtually ended.
That's not true either.
Well, they've not.
There's quite a lot of vapor trails across Bristol at the moment as aircraft start to resume flying across the Atlantic, for example.
Yeah, but many countries are certainly the ones which have actually been successful in controlling COVID are not allowing people coming in. I mean, my friend is going back to New Zealand next week. She will have to spend 2 weeks in a hotel before she can go on to meet her family.
So what about all the people who are being killed by these measures?
Well, I'm not arguing about it. I'm just telling you what's happening. You know as well as I do that this is what's been going on. Everybody, we've been bombarded with all of this information for months now. And, you know, different parts of the world are pursuing different strategies
well,
in relation to
what we've been
this.
Bombarded with is a propaganda narrative, effectively, a one-sided propaganda narrative. We're going to hear some of the other side tonight. These are the voices that you're not allowed to hear, for example, on the BBC. And one of those is the protests going on in London almost all the time. If I talk to my London friends, I find that there's actually loads of protests going on in London that are simply not being reported at all. And here's one which involves one of the ringleaders of the... direct action people, Piers Corbyn, and the protest is called Drink Against the Curfew. So the idea is that people all get together in the street. As the curfew time comes along, then everyone is drinking in the street openly in defiance of these laws. And we'll be hearing in a little while from Lord Sumption about why he thinks that the laws aren't actually lawful. But let's have a listen now to a report on RT again. It's the second RT report we've had about stuff which the mainstream press in Britain are not telling us about. The first one was that film about deaths caused by the police outside custody, not in custody this time. That's the ultra-violence film by Ken Farrow. But this one here is from RT, and it's a report, a very short one, just about a minute long, on a protest called Drink Against the Curfew last weekend.
We're here to drink against the curfew, to oppose the lockdowns, all the lockdowns, oppose job losses caused by lockdowns, oppose all of it, the end of normal democracy, the end of even the rights to organise ourselves in the streets. If you notice, everything they do is taking away the rights of people to be effective, to organise and even talk to each other. We're going to pay none of these fines for the new normal and the new world order. They're arresting people who protest, as you can see here. But we'll carry on. In the end, the police cannot hold down the population, and the population is out getting angry.
Stop! Off our streets!
said it's Piers Corbyn there, Martin, out in London. I think that was last Saturday evening, with a whole group of people stood there defiantly drinking, defying the police to arrest them.
Yes, I was aware that these things were going on, but I can't see what your point is about this, other than to publicise what's happening, which was perfectly okay.
Well, the point is that there's a breakdown in the rule of law. People just don't believe in these rules.
Well, if you actually look at the opinion polls in the country, you will find that the majority want a clear steer on what they should and shouldn't do. A minority are opposed to lockdowns, but they're a minority.
Well, opinion polls obviously can be manipulated as well, can't they?
They can, but I don't think you should kid yourself that everybody is on board with the positions of Piers Corbyn.
I'm not saying that, am I? No, I'm not kidding myself that everyone's on board with it, Martin. All I'm saying is that there's a very big side effect that Piers Corbyn pointed out there, and that is that the police are now preventing people from organising in the street, going to protest, demonstrating, this sort of thing as well. We're going to be hearing a little bit more about that in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, there is clearly a lot of social tension surrounding what's been going on. Nobody denies that. But you will find that there is a broad spread of opinions about what should and shouldn't happen next. And you can't just big up one section of society as if they represent the broader opinion.
Well, that's what the BBC are doing, particularly, for example, with the anti-Semitism scandal. What I'm trying to do here, and I think you know this really in your heart of hearts, is to present a balanced opinion to it. I mean, we're getting all sorts about the what is happening. I mean, I'm just interested to see if you think that there's a psychological and an economic warfare operation going on the British public here, like I do. We see a bias in the press, and we also see ordinary people being forced out of their jobs, so they simply don't have the resources to organise anymore. And this is really a way of crushing any kind of civil society organisation, pressure groups, and these sorts of groups.
Well, you know, I mean, we've had this debate week in, week out. I'm of the opinion that COVID is in fact a biological warfare attack on China. The Chinese have now got their economy.
Well, blew back here.
Yes, because they needed to blow back here so that they could bail out the banks. Don't forget, the banks started collapsing in September. The Israeli Defense Forces, bringing them back into the argument, they were tipped off by the Defense Intelligence Agency in November.
Okay, well, let's just get to something. Let's cut to the chase here, because do you believe that there is a second wave of hundreds of deaths of people who are actually directly dying after catching this virus and have not been falsely put on their death certificates?
I think there are more deaths than there were. And it's definitely going in the wrong direction.
Well, I think one of the most interesting investigations this week is through this hashtag, Film Your Test Centre. A great initiative. I don't know who took it, but whoever it is, it's a big slap on the back from me. But he's basically asking, he's been to his test centre and there's nobody there. So he said, well, look, it can't just be me. What about other people around the country? Let's see, where is this amazing wave of people that are ill with COVID-19 that are testing positive, thousands and thousands of them all the time? And so what he's done is he's asked people to go down to their nearest COVID test centre and literally talk to the people and the staff and film them to see if they're busy, if there are great long queues of cars, of individuals, or what. And this is what he found. But this is a compilation of all places from all over the country, which is about 4 minutes long. But there are about 15 different test centres which are visited here. And there's quite a weird pattern emerges of activity or inactivity.
The government are obtaining thousands of positive tests per day. No queues of people. Looks like I'm going to be approached.
Wait, say that again.
I'm not allowed to film.
You're not allowed to film. Where?
So we have Southampton COVID testing centre. See signs up for it everywhere. COVID-19 testing site. Loads of people here today for the pandemic, are they? Where's all the people? Where's all the people? Where's all the people? All the people riddled with coronavirus? No one? No. Sorry?
Not allowed.
Not allowed to film?
Yeah.
Says who? Says who? It's public property. You can do what I want. Thank you.
New testing site in the virus hotspot that is Redbridge. Activity minimal.
University of Greenwich Medway campus. A grand total of nobody sitting there doing nothing whatsoever.
Another empty COVID-19 testing facility. A school in Hastings. Let's see if we can ask some questions. Hello, are you willing to answer some questions?
No, of course you're not today, sir.
Why would you not want me recording? Well, you mean the empty test site? This is the third one I've been to in 24 hours. You're all empty. But let's go up to the queue. What queue? Look! Look, there's nobody here! Where are all the sick people?
Here in Bedford, and we're going to go and ask them a couple of questions. Well, there's no one here, as you can see.
Are you recording?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did you not record, please?
Is it a top secret government institute, this
Apple Park? I
am. So you can't tell us how many people you've got coming in every day?
It's empty! We've been here twice, on two different occasions. There's not a single patient. Why is that?
We did get patients.
When?
How many?
Are we just turning up at the wrong time?
3 days running. Absolutely dead.
I've been sat here for 15 minutes, not a single car has come in, not a single car has gone out.
Test centre in Leeds, no one here, more staff than people, lunchtime on a Friday.
You can see it's jam-packed, my God, it's overwhelmed, Saturday afternoon.
This is midday on a Saturday, and once again we are empty. There is not a single person here.
Hi, we're at our local testing centre here in Bedford, and we're going to go and ask them a couple of questions. Well, there's no one here, as you can see. You want to ask the guy?
Hello, yeah, I'd just like to ask a few questions.
Are you recording?
Yeah.
Yes. Slough Test Centre. Slough is a massive town just outside of London. It's in Berkshire. A huge population, so I would have thought people would have been queuing up. So it's not as busy as I thought it would be. Where are all these cars?
Absolutely empty. No one around. No one around. I'm just inquiring how busy you are.
Steady.
Steady. It's not very busy at the moment.
It's lunchtime, it might be throughout.
Well, yeah, but lunchtime it'd be busier then, wouldn't it? You can't have it both ways, can you? No, I'm just seeing how busy this is, you know, because we're getting reports on the news and stuff, and what we're seeing on the news is not reflected in real life.
We'd have to go through to the media department, I'm afraid.
No, I don't need that. I'm here, aren't I?
Yeah.
I can see that no one's here.
So here we are. It's the 27th of October, 1:30 p.m. We are at Oxford Parkway Station. This is the biggest testing station in the area. Oh, what can you see in there? Looks like they're having a nice little lunch break. Look at the amount of staff there are. It's absolutely ridiculous. It stood about, and this is one of the biggest test centres in the Oxfordshire area. So there you have it, guys. There you have it.
Well, Panorama didn't do it. Twitter did it, and somebody putting out a hashtag, film your test centre, nobody at any of these test centres, Martin. I don't think they even found a single one. The only person that said, oh, it's very busy here, was, if you have a look at the actual film, was being sarcastic. There was nobody there at all. So what's going on?
I don't know, Tony. What do you think's going on?
Well, it's fraud, isn't it? We're getting a fraud through the media that there is this amazing wave of people who are all getting sick with COVID-19 and dying, where actually the test centres are showing that there's nobody really there doing this. And so it's very easy to do this with the press if you're an unscrupulous editor or manager. Or even a journalist, you can put this stuff out and you can say that there's this terrible pandemic there. But unless people are actually seeing it for themselves at their local test centre, where lots and lots of people are testing positive, then they can be easily conned.
Well, I mean, there's a widespread understanding that the test and trace system in this country is simply not fit for purpose. And it hasn't been. Don't forget, we didn't even start with doing it.
Well,
we had no test centres.
This is another topic. You've just changed the topic, haven't you? What about the test centres?
The test centres are being run by Serco and Deloitte. And it doesn't surprise me at all that they're not actually very effective.
And maybe that they're coming. Actually, both the last 2 weeks, we've had evidence on this programme of people who have said that they didn't have a test at all. Or in fact, several people, at least this is just anecdotal testimony, saying that dead people people, tests were not taken, and yet came back positive. So is there a financial incentive on these private companies to produce lots of positive tests?
Well, they've certainly got no penalty clauses in the contracts that they've been given. What you've got there is anecdotal evidence, Tony.
I don't think it is. I think it's pretty comprehensive evidence from right across the country.
Well, you can say that.
I mean, have a look at the film. I'll tell you what, that's all one right. thing I would definitely do is I'll put that film up, which is a 5 minute or so long, film, from the eminent bunch of, Film Your Test Center hashtaggers, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So people can have a good look at it. But, I mean, it just seemed to me that we're living through an attempt. I mean, this is a very important stage in this whole plandemic, is that, yes, we had a wave of people dying back in March and April and May, but the idea is to keep it all going until the next flu season starts at the end of December, January, February. This is a very important stage to keep the fear going. And I think even you will admit, Martin, that the deep state does use fear in order to try and control populations.
Yes, it does. But of course, there is also objective measures of more people are being hospitalised and more people are dying. And it's not just...
Well, that's not objective, is it, either? Because if you start ramping up tests which aren't reliable, in fact, the inventor of the PCR test himself has said that you should never use this to diagnose an illness, because all it does is indicates whether you may have it or may not. And then you need to have a further diagnosis to see if you have got it. And yet what's happening with these PCR tests is that the population are being told through the BBC, etc., that all the people that test positive have the disease. Well, the inventor of the test said that you cannot use it for that, and so it's not necessarily true. So if you're testing everybody that goes into hospital, quite a lot of people that go into hospital die, and many of those people have not died of COVID-19. But if you're getting false positives for those people that are in there, or maybe they've had COVID-19, there's still a little bit floating around in their system, and they've beaten it off using their immune system, they will be classed as COVID deaths now.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you, Tony. I'm just pointing out that the broader opinion than the one you're presenting takes this as a serious threat. And it's not just in Britain, it's around the world. And I'll come back to what I said earlier. China is not going to be the only country in the world to have positive growth this year, because they squeezed COVID out at the very early stages, and now everybody's back to work, back to school, back to doing everything.
Well, that's a great segue, because we're going to be talking about the police state emerging here, Martin, which they've already got in China. And this is the Supreme Court judge, former Supreme Court judge, Lord Sumption. And his YouTube seemed to have been sabotaged. I tried to download this, and all I got was a blank file. Most of the other YouTubes, if you try and download them, they're fine. But this one was blank, so I had to go to quite a lot of trouble to get you this little clip from Lord Sumption. It's about an hour and 20 minutes long talk he gives about the legal standing of the lockdowns. But he had all sorts of interesting things to say about whether this is all legal and whether it isn't. He starts off, and it's actually quite a boring rambling thing, explaining how for quite a long period of time that none of the stuff that the government were imposing, including the police, was actually within the law. So they then brought it within the law, and they're now making these what he calls ruling by decree. Anyway, let's have a listen to Lord Sumption. And again, this is one of those clips, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later.
On the 30th of August, the police served a £10,000 fixed penalty notice on Mr. Piers Corbyn for addressing a rally against masks in Trafalgar Square. The regulations contain an exception for political protest, provided that the organisers have agreed a risk assessment and taken reasonable steps to ensure safety. On the 26th of September, the police broke up a demonstration against the government's measures, whose organisers had agreed a risk assessment with the local authority and had taken reasonable steps to ensure safety. The police claimed to have done this because some of the demonstrators had not acted in accordance with the arrangements made by the organisers. So they cleared the square using batons with considerable violence, injuring about 20 people who were guilty of nothing other than attending an apparently lawful protest. There is, of course, a notable piece of selection involved in these actions. No such fines, arrests or assaults have been seen in other demonstrations, such as those organised by Black Lives Matter or Extinction Rebellion, which did not observe social distancing either, but were thought by the police to have greater public support. The Mayor of London applauded the police action on the 26th of September. The silence from civil rights organisations such as Liberty has been deafening. The police's powers of summary arrest are regulated by primary legislation, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984. Under Regulation 9.7 of the original lockdown regulations, the government purported to amend that act by enlarging the police's powers of arrest so that they extended to any case in which a policeman reasonably believed that it was necessary to arrest a citizen in order to maintain public health. I need hardly say that the Public Health Act confers no power on ministers to amend other primary legislation in this way. In fact, the police substantially exceeded even the vast powers that they received. In the period immediately after the announcement of the lockdown, a number of chief constables announced that they would stop people acting in a way that they regarded as inessential, although there was no warrant for this in the regulations. One of them threatened to go through the shopping baskets of those exercising their right to obtain supplies so as to ensure that they were not buying anything that a constable might regard as inessential. Other forces set up roadblocks to enforce powers that they did not possess. Derbyshire police notoriously sent up surveillance drones and published on the internet a film clip denouncing people taking exercise in the Derbyshire Fells, something which people were absolutely entitled to do. When I ventured to criticise them in a BBC interview for acting beyond their powers, I received a letter from the Derbyshire Police Commissioner objecting to my remarks on the ground that in a crisis such things were necessary. The implication was that in a crisis, the police were entitled to do whatever they thought fit without being unduly concerned about the limits of their legal powers. That is my definition of a police state.
So that's Lord Sumption, former Supreme Court Judge Martin. He's been one of the lawyers most outspoken, and there's been several, but he's there saying effectively this has allowed the police carte blanche to, well, I mean, it's given the police a license to interpret the law. For example, if the police believe that it's a danger to public health, even though they've got no real qualification to do that, they can just arrest anyone they feel like.
Well, there are clearly issues surrounding the legality or otherwise of whatever measures have been adopted. And I'm willing to listen to any arguments that people want to put forward about that.
So do you think he's exaggerating when he says that these are the powers that you would expect in a police state?
We've got a police state because the loyalist paramilitaries were orchestrated by the deep state to murder loads and loads and loads of people. Does Lord Sumption want to comment on that? Or is he talking about people going to the shops?
Well, I'm talking to you about people going to the shops and people going out for a walk.
Yeah, and therefore the government needs to get its story straight on what people should or shouldn't be doing. Of course, they've been very remiss at that from the very beginning of this crisis, and now nobody's really sure what's supposed to be happening or why. Now, that is a major issue. And of course, if they haven't got the right legal powers and they're basically playing fast and loose with the law, well, that's of a piece with all the other incompetence that we've seen from the get-go.
I mean,
in many
countries, particularly Middle Eastern countries, we've seen these mass demonstrations going on the streets, places like, actually in Eastern Europe, places like Belarus, Ukraine. And really what Lord Sumption is saying there is that police are trying to take it into their power to shut down street demonstrations they don't like and allow to carry on the ones they do like. Now, this does seem to me like a preparation for some sort of orchestrated civil unrest, so that you've got some groups that are favoured by the police and others that are not. Now, that doesn't sound to me like the rule of law.
Well, wasn't the rule of law in Northern Ireland when the loyalist demonstrators tried to march through various nationalist areas. And you basically, the police in Northern Ireland, when it was the Royal Ulster Constabulary, were perceived very much to be on the side of one community against another community. So in actual fact, this has been going on for years, this kind of thing. And of course, as we know, the black community in the inner cities has always had the belief that they've been targeted by the police, then leading to riots in Brixton and St. Paul's and elsewhere. The idea that this is anything new is, to my mind, silly. I mean, it's been going on for years.
No, it hasn't. Not really in central London. I mean, there's been an attempt, in other cities generally, there's been an attempt anyway to make sure that even the right wing get a chance to do their, or you say even neo-Nazi groups have a chance to do their stuff. They're just kept separated from counter-demonstrations and that sort of thing. But now the police have taken it on themselves, particularly with Piers Corbyn, people like Save Our Rights and Stand Up X, etc., to be able to shut down demonstrations at will.
That's because the regulations, however legal or illegal they are, have changed and people are not supposed to be meeting in groups of more than six.
Well, that's not true, is it? Because as Lord Sumption just explained, if you put in a risk assessment and you keep to that risk assessment as the demonstration is ongoing, the spirit of this is to allow, the pandemic regulations are not there to shut down political demonstrations. I mean, you went to one yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, and I think that what happened in Bristol was that the police took an executive decision, which is within their powers, that they were not going to try and break the demonstration up, and they weren't going to try and prevent people from throwing the Colston statue in the water.
So this has got nothing to do with social distancing or anything like that. It's just whether the police actually think that the demonstration is a worthy one or not. Now that is
It's a question of whether they think it's a threat to public order, and that of course is an operational decision for police officers on the ground.
But that's not in the law, so you might say that.
No, it's not in the law. No, the police have the discretion to either tolerate or not to tolerate any demonstration. That's always been the case. So, for example, when loyalists tried to march through the Gavachy Road, the police...
Involved in a civil war quite yet, Ireland, Martin.
Well, no, I know, but the point you're making is that all of these things about police states and so on are very serious questions. People saying, I'm not going to wear a mask when I go into a supermarket is not really on the same scale, is it? There's no, it's a bit trivial.
We're not talking about masks and supermarkets. We're talking about the ability for the... civilian population to actually have political demonstrations, which is absolutely crucial, particularly right now, and also with the potential of foreign wars brewing up in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, etc. If there is such a thing, then surely people should be able to meet as usual and demonstrate it. And it just seems to me that the police are using this plandemic as an excuse to shut down any demonstration that they don't like, just as we've seen the mass media, particularly in the West, they report some demonstrations and they ignore others, ignoring ones like Piers Corbyn's demonstration in Oxford Street, the Drink Against the Curfew one. That's ignored because it's not supported. Now, we're going down a road here where the media and the police are deciding what is and isn't allowed to take place. That is a police state.
There's already been a police state which has been involved in things like blowing up the Twin Towers, the 7/7 attacks, the loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland blowing up Dublin and Monaghan.
It would help if you stuck. Yeah, but 7/7, I can certainly understand. But these other things are extraneous. We're here talking about normal civilian life here in the UK. And so, what would you say about 7/7 that would compare to either shutting down these demonstrations or not allowing them to take place?
I'm basically saying that we've got real problems with a police state, and of course we were discussing that in the first part of the programme. Now, you've got a very vocal minority that does not like these lockdowns. That's quite clear. Piers Corbyn has put himself at the head of that kind of
thing. I think it's fair to say that it's not just that they don't like them, that they have a very well put together critique of them, which is backed by lots of medical professionals.
Yes, and lots of other medical professionals don't agree with them.
It's not just a preference, yeah?
No, lots of other medical professions don't agree with them.
Well, lots of people don't agree with you on 9/11. That doesn't mean to say they're right, does it?
No, and it doesn't mean to say that I'm
but
right.
These sorts of things have to be able to be thrashed out in the public forum when they're not being talked about in the media and they're not being talked about in Parliament.
I'm perfectly happy to talk about them, but I'm not necessarily going to give way and say, oh yes, Piers Corbyn's right about all of this, and it's all got something to do with...
Nobody's saying that. It's about whether he has a right, and others have a right, to get out on the streets and demonstrate. But one of the big effects of all of this, of course, is a psychological effect on people of being isolated. Many people would say, without good reason, being told you can't see loved ones, can't see relatives, that, you know, when your mother or father or another loved one in your family is dying, you're not allowed to visit them, this sort of thing. And Emma Kenny is a psychiatrist, and she has a YouTube channel. I noticed quite an impassioned piece by her this week. Emma Kenny, MBPSS and MBACP, another one of those experts in the topic that is not being heard or listened to by the BBC or anybody else in the mainstream press.
There is no Build Back Better for most of us here in the UK, and for some, there will be no Build Back at all. And why are we even at this point? Because aside from week 17 of the pandemic in mid-April, all cause mortality rates this year are comparable to recent years. And 99% of coronavirus are mild, yet we continue to destroy the lives and livelihoods of millions of people in the UK. How have we arrived here? And how is this being allowed to continue? Because if I am to draw any conclusions from this situation, it is that the coronavirus restrictions have been branded as being brought in to protect the vulnerable and have done the absolute opposite. In fact, I do see coronavirus as one of the biggest threats to humanity, but only because of the utterly inhumane restrictions that are killing many, many more than they ever came close to protecting. When I read the statistics on child suicide and it lists deaths between the ages of 10 and 19 years of age, 10, I know that society is fundamentally broken. And a society that continues to accept this is barbaric, hostile and anti-democratic. If we continue to support restrictions, knowing the catastrophic collateral damage that is happening with every second that passes at a cost to everything else, then we are knowingly and therefore willingly choosing to kill many other people by many other means, children included, whether that be from suicide, cancer, heart disease, poverty, social isolation or dementia, to name just a few. We cannot turn away from the uncomfortable truth that the government is not only failing to protect us, but now actively choosing to harm us, to harm our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends. They are failing to protect our high streets, our entrepreneurs, our businesses, our futures. And whilst you may find it hard to look that reality in the eye because of what that reality may mean, now is not the time to turn away. Because without you, without all of you, my lone voice is just a whisper.
So that's Emma Kenny. She's a psychologist talking there about what she believes is a very powerful effect that the isolation that's coming with these lockdowns is having on people of all ages, being told that you can't have contact with loved ones and that sort of thing. Martin, she's talking about there is this whole area of kind of collateral damage that by having these restrictions on people's movement, etc. And we'll be hearing in a minute about how our own mayor here in Bristol wants to increase restrictions here in the city, that it has an enormous effect on people psychologically.
Well, nobody's denying that there are knock-on effects of such measures. But the consensus of medical opinion is that they are justified.
Well, I totally disagree with you.
No, the consensus is not where you're at, Tony.
You're just presenting a view of a particular faction of medical people, professionals.
Well, you're presenting a particular faction.
The revolving door faction as a consensus. It's definitely not a consensus out there amongst medical professionals. There's a big discussion, a big
All
debate.
Right.
And that debate, there is an attempt to control that debate by preventing critical voices, expert critical voices like her, being heard.
Okay, I'm perfectly willing to listen to everybody, Tony, but you've got to accept that, and because we're not the mainstream, we don't have any mainstream people on our show, so I have to bat for them. And I will bat for them and point out that we have, in fact, got a medical establishment in this country set up over many, many years, and they have been the sage experts and all the rest of it have been saying we need a tougher lockdown, otherwise we're going to lose control.
But it hasn't worked, has it?
They were ignored by the government, as you well know. The government were advised to take a lockdown stance, and they decided not to do it because they ignored the advice that they were being given by their own medical professionals.
You're harumphing in a rather faux fashion, because you know as well as I do that the virus was well around in Britain back in March, and you're saying that we could have locked down. Of course we couldn't at that point to stop any spread like New Zealand and places like this. And actually that's what they did do in March. They did have a lockdown.
Yes, and at that point, things started to get back under control. And then, of course, Rishi Sunak decided to go and eat out to help out. And it's now eaten out to help out because they're not going to fund skilled children's dinners over the holidays. There's a lot of bitterness about all of this, Tony, and a lot of it's to do with the incompetence of this Tory government, who didn't take seriously what was going on until they were whacked in the face with a wet fish. And, of course, they're now... what will happen, I will predict this absolutely 100%, there will be a national lockdown in England. There's already got one in Ireland. And of course, eventually we will have to get into line.
And is that because there's so many people dying of COVID-19, or are they dying with COVID-19?
Tony, the death toll for COVID-19, you can look it up on your computer now. It's definitely going back to where it was at the beginning of the year.
And is that because we're getting all these tests?
No, it's because
tests?
People are dying. It's not a question of being tested. They're dead.
Are they dying with or of
COVID-19? Tony,
you... And you think it doesn't make a difference?
No, what you're trying to do is question the stats that the government
are using. Of course I am, yeah.
Yes, and I'm just saying you can question the stats. You've got a degree in humanities. There's lots of medical professionals who don't agree with you. And you can find medical professionals who agree with you, but I haven't got the clips to bring in people who aren't going to agree with your medical professionals. I'm not a medical professional, but when I get on an aeroplane, I tend to trust the engineers to do it properly because I presume that somebody has checked them and checked their qualifications.
Well, that's a very big presumption to make, isn't
it? Well, it is, isn't it?
But of course, even on Armenian Airways.
It's very easy to find people who critique from various perspectives view.
What you're trying to do is present this as a consensus when actually it's not a consensus at all.
No.
It's a false consensus presented by Sky, the BBC, etc. Exactly as we had on the September the 11th attacks, actually, they presented a consensus that it was all Bin Laden was behind and they didn't allow any dissenting voices on back in 2001 to say, no, it's not Bin Laden, it's somebody else. Well, that was exactly the same as what's happening today.
I'm prepared to argue about 9/11 because it's the sort of thing I've actually got qualifications to talk about. But something like a medical epidemic, I tend to look to doctors to tell me what to do. Now, the sage, whatever you may say about it, they are there to decide what is and what is not happening medically. Now, they have made it absolutely clear that they called for a lockdown some weeks ago.
Okay, and there's regulatory capture in the financial sector, but not at Sage, with people from the pharmaceutical industry who have financial interests in this?
I am willing to listen to the argument that Sage may not have the final answer on everything. But on the other hand, I don't think that you can just dismiss what they're saying and then wheel up anybody that just agrees with your view
I'm not certainly not dismissing it. I'm critiquing it, and I'm explaining to you, and for probably the fourth or fifth time now, that there is an enormous amount of financial and industry effort going on here to bump the figures up, and that's exactly what I think is going on. And another person who agrees with me popped up on talk radio earlier this week, speaking to Richard Madeley, who's doing a programme on there at the moment. I think maybe it's just for a week while one of their presenters is away. But his name's Neil Oliver. You'll know him from the Coast programmes. He's extremely worried about the way, particularly that the lockdowns are being increased in Scotland, where he doesn't believe that it's the right way of doing things at all. So here's Neil Oliver now talking about the way this is all being dealt with in this almost fanatical religious fashion.
Lockdown hasn't worked. I can't put it any more simply. My interpretation is that based on what happened during the summer and in the aftermath, lockdown doesn't work. It makes me think it's a bit like watching or looking back at the way in which the generals tried to fight the First World War. You know, for the longest time, that was a war that, I'm not saying it was a needless war, it was a war that had to be fought. But for once they got into the trenches, the generals took years of trying to think how actually to win the war. And for year after year, until they came up with the right tactics, all they did was throw more and more men into no man's land to be cut down. And it was the only thing they could think to do. And then eventually, after years of that slaughter and that carnage, they learned properly how to prosecute the war, how to win the war. And the Allies did win the war with the appropriate tactics. But by that time, by the end of the war, there were 20 million dead and 20 million wounded. And the population of Europe had been so broken down in body and soul that it was then vulnerable to the flu epidemic that came in 1918-1919 and killed a further 100 million people. But there was a callous disregard for individual human life that went on until the appropriate tactics were found. And this constantly banging away at the concept of lockdown is just attritional. It's not going to do anything except demoralise the people, destroy the economy, and result in the collateral damage of all the deaths that will result from not being treated, cancer, heart disease, depression, everything else. Heaven knows how many people are about to or have already taken their own lives on account of all of this. And simply on the altar of lockdown and COVID-19, lives are being sacrificed. And we know that lockdown doesn't work. And the whole thing is beginning to take on a bit of a religious feel. If I've been saying all along that, you know, on the odd occasion where I do go into a shop, I keep away from shops really, but when I do go into a shop, I wear a mask. I've been doing it, and it, I feel like it feels like a cowardly gesture in a sense, but I'm complying. But although I say at the same time that I don't think masks are actually necessary, that's a heresy. It's not enough to comply with the rules. It's required in a quasi-religious way to say, I believe this works. You know, you have to be standing there and saying that the tactics that the government are using, you have to declare faith in them. And look what's coming down the line next. I mean, this the vaccine, the fabled vaccine, that's going to be like the Eucharist. That's going to be like the communion wine. In order to demonstrate your faith, you're going to have to join the queue and take the blood of the Saviour, you know, to, you know, if you have hopes of eternal life. But more than anything else, it will be a political statement that you are lockstep with the true faith, the true religion. You know, in the old days, you know, there were schisms in the Christian church. They all thought they were Christians, but there was the right kind of Christian and the wrong kind. And the dominant party didn't negotiate or speak reasonably to the other side. They called them heretics and burnt them at the stake. Now, the science at the moment is the religion, but there's the good science and there's the bad science. And if you're aligned with the bad science, as it's been characterised by the majority of the media and by the government, then you're a heretic and you're not to be talked to. You're to be dismissed and, in a metaphorical sense, you're to be burnt at the stake. So the whole thing has become an article of faith. You have to say not only that you're complying with the rules, but that you believe in your heart, like a good soldier, that what is being done is absolutely right. And I find it all sinister, if I'm being perfectly honest.
Now, I don't suppose you believe in your heart, Martin, that all that they're doing is right, do you?
No, I don't. I think it's been absolutely appallingly managed from the get-go. Lockdown is the final resort when you haven't got a proper test and trace system in place, like they've got in South Korea, Taiwan, Kerala, China, big country, a lot of people, but they did the right things in the right order. We're going to come and discuss the Chinese social credits, Chris, in a minute. What's happened here in the West is that the neoliberal countries, Brazil, United States, Britain have had a very, very bad COVID war, which is why we've got all this kind of lockdown, not lockdown, because what you should have done is jumped on it at the very beginning, which is exactly what happened in China. And of course, the Chinese economy is growing strongly now, not as strong as it was before the crisis, and they're ultimately going to be the biggest, strongest economy on the planet as the US collapses into civil war and chaos as we head towards Christmas, because it's actually about World War III. Not about mask wearing.
Well, why is it such a good idea to have a lockdown when there's not been any more deaths due to COVID-19 as there were between 2017 and 2018 of flu? It seems to me the whole thing is like a obsessional, well, it's almost like a kind of obsessional idea, hypochondria. It's a obsessional COVID obsession.
We need to have lockdowns and we need to have all of this because we've got to bail the banks out. And we bail the banks out. If we had bailed the banks out without a lockdown.
So this is just
COVID,
as a cover for the bank bailout.
Yeah, the COVID attack on China was stopped by the Chinese Communist Party and their intelligence services. They allowed it to flow back over the US so that they could bail the banks out in September. Yeah. Because the banks collapsed in September. We know from the Times of Israel that the Israeli Defense Forces, who we mentioned in the first hour, were tipped off that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China in November. So the DIA knew that there was going to be a pandemic. So there was a pandemic. The pandemic took place, but the Chinese jumped all over it. China is now back to work. They're not wearing masks. They're not doing anything. Everybody is back to work because they did the right things. Well, we didn't do the right things, and we're now in a mess whatever
are,
we do.
Hang on, they certainly are wearing masks, and they do
not. Anymore, Tony, they're not.
Yes, they are in many places, and they also have to wear masks. For example, in Hong Kong,
they showed a picture of Wuhan where they were having a massive pool party. Nobody was wearing masks because they've tested their way out of it. We haven't done that, which is why we're in a touch of mess.
You're not allowed, Martin.
The options aren't good.
You're not allowed. Well, I don't agree. I think the options are: you just relax everything. We don't need a lockdown. We absolutely don't.
But well, I'm not going to agree with that, Tony.
And also, if you have a look at what's going on in China, you absolutely have to wear masks. In Hong Kong, you're not allowed out without a mask, and you get a 500 euro fine if you're found without in the street with no mask on. So that's just not true. Maybe what you've seen is a nice picture of some specially arranged thing by the Chinese government. I'm not sure. But anyway, here in Bristol, our mayor is straining at the bit to increase the restrictions on Bristol people, and he's very overjoyed to hear that there's been some government money for him to employ a whole bunch of MIRTH inspectors, that is to say the COVID marshals, to go around and see if anyone's getting too many people together or enjoying themselves in order to stop them. So here's our very own mayor, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees now, supposedly a Labour guy, talking about what he's going to do is something called Tier 1 Plus, which is being introduced at Bristol at the moment, even though central government has said they'd rather you didn't introduce another Tier 1 Plus because it actually makes things more complicated and more difficult to understand, but he's doing it anyway.
We are looking at options for a Tier 1 Plus approach, which is remaining in Tier 1, but taking some targeted interventions, actions to influence people's behaviour and stem the spread of the virus. The numbers will go up over the coming weeks because there's always a lag anyway, but beginning to put in place those measures that will reduce the ability of the virus to spread. That, if that is successful, and if we think that is having an impact, and if alongside us government think that's having an impact, then we will stand a chance of remaining in Tier 1 Plus. If it doesn't, there's an inevitable alternative, and that is the prospects of Tiers 2 and 3. That is obviously because they are so blunt, that's what we'd like to avoid. But what we do have to do is take actions to stem the spread of COVID. And if we have to go into those tiers, then that's the path we will have to do. But we are doing all we can in the immediate term to avoid that.
So that's Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees. And Martin, he wants Tier 1 Plus, and he's very happy to receiving this government money. He's employing a load of people to go out on the streets as the MIRTH inspectors, the COVID enforcers.
Yep. I mean, and we've now got a situation where we're not quite clear. In different parts of the country, there are different regulations, and the general understanding of what we were or were not supposed to be doing has dissipated completely. So we're in a bit of a mess, aren't we?
Ultimately, though, it doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense to have these different precautions in different parts of the country. Certainly in Wales, doesn't seem to be. I mean, I went to check this week, driving in and out of Wales a few times to see if there's any restrictions on going in and out of Wales. And of course, there isn't. They have this thing where they do they have the police on the TV at the border sitting there, waiting for these unsuspecting car drivers to stop them and turn them back. But of course, that isn't actually really out there. I mean, there may be one or two, but the actual amount of traffic, I was quite surprised. Just as the first week of the Welsh so-called firebreak, there's no restrictions, it seems, at all to me, people going in and out of Wales. And actually, people are just going about their business as they always did.
Well, that's anecdotal evidence, Tony. But
I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yes, okay, but it's only anecdotal evidence.
The actual shopping centres are closed down, but all the main businesses seem to be still open.
Yeah, well, the problem from an economic point of view with this COVID crisis is that even in countries where they haven't had a severe lockdown like Sweden, the economy's taken a hit because lots of people have stayed home. Because if going out to get a cheap meal's all very well, but quite a lot of people, somebody like me, for example, nearly 61 with blood pressure issues, why would I risk my life for a cheap meal? And of course I wouldn't. And of course lots of other people wouldn't either. As it was suggested that there was going to be, that COVID was coming back, the footfall in the shopping centres went down anyway. And that is what's going to happen. The countries which have actually beaten COVID, because they've beaten it, New Zealand, China, very important, one quarter of humanity, they don't have to worry about that at all because they squash the virus from the get-go.
Well, you're getting very aerated, Martin, aren't you, about this as usual? But of course they haven't beaten it and they haven't got rid of the virus. They are still got it to come, and all they've done is they've kicked the can down the road.
Yes, well, they've kicked the can down the road, but as long as they keep preventing people coming in from outside, then they will be able to function. We won't.
So is this, I mean, surely at some point people get this virus and then that's it, you know, the whole thing will burn out, and I would suggest that's where we are now.
Well, you're suggesting that, Tony, but that's not what the main medical opinion is
about. Well, it's not what the government medical opinion is. But we're not here as a government spokes programme.
No, we're not. And I'm not here for to be the Tony Gosling spokesperson either. I don't agree with your views on this, Tony, and I put it on the record that I don't agree with them. Fine. We don't have to agree. Well, it's a free country.
I don't think you need to put it on the record. It's really obvious for the last 3 months. Okay. Yeah. So how police forces across the UK will enforce the COVID rules over Christmas? There was a whole bunch of stories went out, I think it was on Tuesday this week, right around the country, with the chief constables saying that we have the right to come into your homes and break up your Christmas parties if you've got more than six people in the house.
Yes. That is the position.
And you think that's okay?
Well, lots of people do think it's okay. If you look at the opinion polls, quite a lot of people think, well, if that's what it is, that's what people want, is a clear steer.
I think what you hear here, the impression you're trying to give, Martin, is that everybody agrees with you.
No.
I'm just putting an opposite point of view, saying that I think it's an absolute barbaric idea that the police will come in and break up Christmas parties with people, because unless they're for example, the BBC presenter Victoria Derbyshire said, well, I'm going to just simply break this rule. She's one of the only honest journalists left at the BBC, by the way, and I don't know I don't think so. I hope not.
I think she has.
Has she? So yeah. Is that a good thing? Should we be sacking journalists disagree with the government? I think you think that we should.
Well, no. I don't agree. I mean, she's obviously a very serious journalist. Well, the fact is that these rules are there. Some people accept them. Some people don't. The police are never going to be able to enforce that. You know, the limits of what the police can actually do are very great. And ultimately, countries which have been successful in dealing with this pandemic have relied really upon ordinary people's common sense and people to actually voluntarily to do the things that they're asked to do.
First of all, Martin, I don't know where you got this idea of Victoria Derby. She seemed to be just making this up, but no, she's not been sacked. She's apologised and retracted her comments.
No, so I thought she'd been previously sacked for something else. They removed it. If you remember, we covered it on this show that the Victoria Derbyshire show was closed down.
Well, the BBC Two programme was closed
down. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
She's still on the television. I don't know if you ever watch it, but she's there doing the BBC on a, I think it's the BBC Two on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday mornings. So she's definitely not been sacked, no.
All right, well, I thought she had been removed because I remember that we covered this some months ago that she'd been removed.
Well, but she said basically that she would break the rule of six at Christmas if she needed to see parents. And she's saying basically because there are seven people in her family and they were not going to do some silly thing where they go around and someone has to draw the short straw and go and sit in the garden shed for the duration of Christmas.
Yep. Well, there's going to be all of these things are to come. We will find out what the situation will be at Christmas and what the regulations may actually be.
Will you be obeying them?
I will do. I'm not a COVID sceptic in the way that you are, Tony. I'm prepared.
Just yes or no will do.
I will obey them as long as I consider that they've been sensibly argued for and they can show me what the scientific basis for what they're doing is. on that basis, I'm willing to give them a hearing and also to cooperate. That is what's been, you know, the countries which have been very successful in dealing with this, that's exactly what they've done. And, you know, in New Zealand, everybody's going to have a great Christmas. People from outside won't be able to go there. My friend Shelley is going over there now so that by Christmas time she'll have had 2 weeks in quarantine and she'll be able to do Christmas with her family. And you can have any number you like in New Zealand because they've done things right. And the government have just been overwhelmingly re-elected.
Well, you know what? I think it's quite feasible that people here in this country can have any number they like if they are prepared to do the research and do the thinking and listen to some of the critical voices, which you don't seem to be prepared to.
No, I'm listening to the critical voices. I don't necessarily have to agree with them, Tony. That you're presenting a rather totalitarian point of view, whereas if I don't agree with your position on COVID,
it's not a totalitarian point of view at all, of course, and you're just being provocative saying that. But the idea is that I think people could just enjoy Christmas as normal here just by simply turning their back on this Tory government and ignoring them.
Well, that may happen, and people may do that, and the police may or may not do something about it. But of course,
will the crisis actually die of it? This is the question, isn't it?
The death toll, as far as I'm aware, has risen. It was 200 a day this week.
It's risen exactly alongside the number of tests. Isn't that funny?
The number of tests is obviously the more people you test, the more people you're going to find. The death rate is much more significant. Because that's definitely people who are dying. Not a question of being tested or asymptomatic, dead. And I think that is what...
But there's been no increase to the normal amount of people dying at this time of year. In fact, the whole year, we were hearing earlier, I don't know if you were listening, that there's been no increase in the actual death rate generally this year at all. So we've had a whole pandemic for nothing.
Well, that's what you may assert that. But of course, in actual fact, because we've had these various lockdown measures, the normal deaths from flu have been prevented because we've had all these lockdown measures. There's lots of arguments about all of this, Tony, as I'm sure you're well aware. And ultimately, ordinary people, I've got to some extent listen to experts, whoever they may be. And of course, the experts don't all agree, well, as you pointed out.
If we can find them. Anyway, so one aspect to all of this, which I find really particularly irksome, is the way that social media, which used to be the place you go to get all these different points of view, is being censoring people. And somebody I'm quite friendly with, at least on Twitter, and I chit chat with her sometimes, is an old campaigner called Frances Leader. She's been involved in the anti-fracking campaign for many years and many, many other campaigns. And I had a long chat with her. It's about an hour-long interview, really, about some of her past and her activities back in the 1960s and 70s. And also finished up with talking to her about COVID. But the reason I got hold of her is because I noticed that her Twitter account had been suspended. Amazingly, she wrote to them explaining why she had been linking 5G to COVID-19, citing the fact that it was actually a UN person, a report that she had copied and that Twitter had then taken down. But she was saying, and maybe you could just comment on this, Martin, that there's a whole load of people out there who do nothing more but follow activists and then report them all the time to Twitter for saying something that they don't think is correct. Anyway, this time she will tell her own story about what happened once Twitter had a look and whether she got her account back or not. This is Frances Leader.
There is something rather creepy coming along here, isn't there? The idea that Twitter determines what is and is not allowed to be discussed.
Well, they said on their comment to me, I just got the impression that this is something they've agreed with the British government and the US government. That, you know, they've been told that they are not to permit alternative explanations for the COVID-19 outbreak. Full stop. You've got to believe what they're telling you. You're not to look for an alternative cause, and certainly not to look for an alternative treatment. And unless you know the true cause of a disease, there's no way you're ever going to find the treatment. I mean,
well, that's fascinating, isn't it? Because the government themselves, right at the start of all of this, decided to the wise way to deal with this was to clear the hospitals out. And move lots of people, elderly people, into care homes, some of whom actually had contracted COVID. So that itself was a horrific act, And they're saying that actually social media and mainstream media should not be able to criticise government policy.
What they did to those old people is nothing short of murder, in my opinion. That was unforgivable, completely unforgivable. I got the impression that we were supposed to be going on lockdown to protect the elderly. And when we discovered that they had emptied out the hospitals into care homes, it was obvious that that was the completely wrong thing to do, because it immediately compromised all the care homes and their staff, and it was murder, in my opinion. It was murder.
So, okay, so what's the outcome with Twitter? They've had a little look at your case.
Yeah, they took all day. I decided to appeal, and that was by about 9:30 this morning. I sent in my appeal.
So do you get much of a chance to appeal? Do you get a lot, you know, you have to send in a written appeal to them, do you?
You get, I honestly, Tony, they are really limited. They give you a 140-digit space in which to make your appeal. There was no waxing lyrical, I can assure you. I just had to phrase my answer as best I could and say that I considered the material I had shared was from legitimate sources, which it was. An ex-UN official, and on the one hand, and both maps came from government sites.
Okay, so that's within about 25 words to do your appeal in.
Yeah.
This is not the High Court, is it?
No. But so I seriously just sent it off and went off to Facebook and spent the rest of the day on Facebook utterly convinced that I was going to be thrown off of Twitter forever for breaking their rule about obeying what the prescribed narrative is. So at 7:00 this evening, I was most stunned to get an email saying that they were deeply sorry and very apologetic, but they appeared to have made a mistake.
So, Francis Leader is back on Twitter after a little nervous day. Martin, this is a little bit weird, isn't it? Because I actually like the whole idea on social media that you can go there. I mean, her post was, in a mild way, linking 5G to COVID-19 and saying that that there is some evidence, very little, but some, that the nanoparticles that might be in a vaccine, they can, once they're in your body, they could be linked up in some way to 5G. But it wasn't her saying this, it's some former UN person, and also the maps that she was showing, which are very interesting, I think, in a weird way, because it does show as if there may be some evidence for it, that the 5G sites were very similar to the actual COVID sites. So it may be pure coincidence, but I like to go to Twitter and I like to go to social media to look at some of this material, which may be coincidence and it may not.
Well, the fact of the matter is that Twitter, as a private corporation, is under no obligation to give people a platform of any kind.
So if Twitter doesn't want to do it, where do we go to get these different points of view? Because we're certainly not getting them from mainstream media.
No, but what should be happening is that you can either have, there are two potential models, isn't there? You've got the sort of what you might call the BBC model, where you should have a full spread of opinions and everybody's gets their go, and you know, we're basically saying that this is the spectrum that you're allowed to have opinions in, and you know, some people might be outside that spectrum, but most people should be in it. Or you just have a free for all where anybody can say anything they want. Twitter is a private corporation; it's got no obligation to say say anything.
You've just said this. You're always saying
the same of the Daily Mail.
Where do we go?
Well, I don't know, Tony. The fact is that the way the media works is that the owners of the Daily Mail are under no obligation to anybody to do anything. They can say anything they like. They can silence people. They can refuse to interview people. They can print lies if they like. And
but this is all about controlling the narrative, isn't it? It seems to be a lot of this going on a bit like during 9/11.
Well, it's all about controlling the narrative because, of course...
And 7-7.
Because when you've got a pandemic, let's just say it was not this pandemic, any pandemic, one of the things that you've got to do is have a clear narrative from the authorities in order to try and deal with the problem.
But why is it a pandemic if no more extra people are dying?
All right, well, you're arguing with the figures. I'm not going to argue with you about the figures. There's plenty of medical opinion out there that this is a serious issue.
Well, they won't argue
and
with those
figures.
It's not
just figures. In Britain.
The actual
it's
death,
not just
the
in
actual,
Britain.
They won't argue with the actual death rate. The death rate is the same as it's been
all right.
Over the last 4 or 5 years.
All right, well, it's not just in Britain where this has happened, has it? All over the world, various authorities have taken various steps to try and deal with this pandemic, some with more success than others.
I don't know if you've seen, but in Singapore, they've halted the use of the flu vaccine this week after nearly 50 people died after taking the flu vaccine.
Same in South Korea.
Singapore has halted the use of this vaccine, yeah. But South Korean government and the authorities there are basically in denial. They're saying even though the families of those people who've died from this vaccine say it's the vaccine that's killed them, the South Korean government are completely in denial. They're trying to brush this under the carpet and carry on with their vaccination program anyway, although of course the people in South Korea, as may be here in weeks and months to come, are not taking this because they don't believe their own government that this is a safe vaccine.
Yep. And that's all this issue. We haven't really touched on vaccines as an issue. But of course, the Western pharmaceutical companies, as we know, have been pushing vaccines on the developing world for many years. But of course, that doesn't mean anything for the Russian or Chinese vaccines, which are developed by the public sector and on a not-for-profit basis.
And also, I mean, just to emphasize the way this is not necessarily about medicine, it's about money and bribery. Wanted dead or alive, reward £100. The glossy leaflet doesn't quite put it like that, but it means the same thing. Refer a friend to a vaccine trial and receive £100. If the person you recommend goes on to participate, we'll give you £100.
Yeah, and of course, what happens in the West, in the capitalist West, is that everything is corrupted by money and profit. Just like Serco and Deloitte have made a complete balls up of test and trace, which is why nobody found anybody at the test and trace places that we heard from earlier. In other parts of the world, the testing and tracing hasn't been done by the private
sector. Well, maybe it's good that test and trace isn't working because it's a fraudulent test anyway.
Well, they've used test and trace in South Korea, in China, in New Zealand, in Kerala in southern India, in various places in the world, in Singapore. They've actually managed to. It's about governance. Where have you got an effective government that can actually do the job?
I mean,
or
Martin,
not?
Can you not we see haven't. How this is potentially going to provoke a civil war in France if the population are told that you're not allowed to leave the house without permission indefinitely, which is what's happened this week?
Well,
a second nationwide France lockdown.
Indeed.
Permission is needed now to leave your home in France.
Well, this is almost a provocation,
isn't it?
Well, it depends whether people obey it or not. The first lockdown, they generally did obey it.
If they were Chinese, they probably would, wouldn't they? But these are not. They're French.
No, indeed. And it may be that, of course, that the Chinese economy will carry on growing and the French economy is going to collapse. And then Macron may lose his election. We'll just have to see, won't we?
It'll be a little while before that happens. But anyhow, so let's look at some international stories now. And in Ukraine, the government has been passing the last day or so these new pro-corruption laws, which almost seem to be sort of formalising the whole idea of Ukraine being run by organised crime. So we've had something quite similar going on here, haven't we, with the law which allows anyone from the government to break the law with impunity. They've got the pro-corruption laws now in Ukraine. Are we going to see more people coming out? I mean, there have been demonstrations in Maidan Square in Kiev again this week.
Well, I haven't followed this story in any great detail, so it's interesting that you should bring it up. But Ukraine is, of course, one of the most corrupt places on the planet, has been for a very long time, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the arrival of Western carpetbaggers and their local allies. And
why is it so corrupt?
Because the oligarchy in Ukraine was able to, with their Western allies, you know, the Hunter Bidens and all the rest of it, the privatizations they forced through allowed the theft of state property on a huge scale. And that, of course, was similar things that was going on in Russia itself until the turnaround when Yeltsin was removed and Putin took control and basically reined in the oligarchy. But, of course, in the Western-oriented Ukraine, the oligarchy is still in firm control.
Hunter Biden, his ex-partner, is saying here's proof Biden is a liar. Lots of suppression, actually, of this Hunter Biden story in the United States.
Yeah, I was discussing it this morning on RT. The New York Post has published extracts from this Hunter Biden laptop, which has come into their hands. But Twitter have basically been trying to block people finding out about it. Now, the New York Post, owned by Murdoch, wants Trump to win the election, so they're quite keen to put this stuff out there. Twitter...
So it's rather than the Russians fixing the elections, you think Twitter versus Murdoch are having a battle here,
so who's
going to win?
You basically got... And don't forget, Twitter is probably owned by pro-Democrat billionaires, and they are trying to prevent the stuff coming out in the New York Post, which the New York Post is trying to push out there. But, of course, both of them are private organisations under no obligation to give the other side a fair point of view. They're just there to push their agenda.
And both of them, of course, are Bilderbergers. They're both in the same elite set. So, in other words, a bit of theatre.
It doesn't really matter who wins the election in the US. The deep state will continue to control policy. It's quite clear that their relation, that the attitude of towards foreign policy, both in the Biden camp and in the Trump camp, is pretty much the same. They're arguing about which country they want to go to war with first: China, Russia, or Iran. But they're basically all talking about we've got to fight these terrible people, and that's what the election. You know, there's no discussion about that. That's the United States policy set in concrete.
Meanwhile, in Nagorno-Karabakh, there is talks taking place tomorrow, apparently, with the US trying to intervene. I mean, are the US going to make any difference, do you think? If this is a US proxy war, I suppose they might.
I think the US are pretending, I mean, this is just speculative, the US are pretending to want peace, but in actual fact, they're quite happy to have this conflict there because it basically causes lots of problems for the Russians, which is why they're also happy to have the upsetting situation in Belarusia. The RAND Corporation produced a document some years ago about how to unbalance Russia by basically causing problems in their neighbourhood, which they find difficult to deal with. So then that prevents them from, from sorting their own problems out. And at the Valdai Club, a couple of weeks ago now, both Lavrov and Putin spoke, and they've basically given up on trying to negotiate with the West.
Okay, what about Thailand? Because we keep hearing about the royal family and how you're never allowed to criticise them. Thankfully, we are here. We do quite a lot. In fact, it's a British pastime having a pop at the royal family, particularly Prince Charles. But Thailand's military dictatorship, Martin, is endangered apparently by impassioned students. But we don't really think of Thailand as a military dictatorship. We think of it as a monarchy, but it's really the same thing.
Well, in actual fact, there are
elections. A bit like Saudi Arabia.
There are elections in Thailand, and the people who are protesting against the government lost them. They are basically pro-Western demonstrators, pretty much like the Hong Kong demonstrators.
So Orange Revolution style, revolution.
It's a colour revolution. Thaksin Shinawatra is Wall Street's favoured boy. And of course, these demonstrators have also, just like in other countries, there have been peaceful demonstrations, and then people have started shooting at the police. The police shoot back. That's created bloodshed. Basically, the Western powers do not like the way that Thailand is basically falling step by step into Chinese sphere of influence. Thailand wants to pursue an independent policy, even-handed towards the West and towards the Chinese. The monarchy, is part of that desire for an independent policy. And basically, the Western powers don't like that, and they're trying to overthrow the current setup in Thailand.
In Nigeria, 3 weeks ago, the army did, according to Amnesty, shoot to kill a load of unarmed demonstrators and then try to cover it up. It's obviously pretty dysfunctional Nigeria, but is anything surprising about the idea that we should not believe anything that the Nigerian government say? I mean, in a way, this is a country that's a victim of these various waves of colonialism, with only puppet leaders of the West being allowed to continue on there. And there is, of course, an enormous amount of linkage between the US, NATO, intelligence services, and who is and is not going to be ruling Nigeria.
Well, Babangida, who's the current president, was in fact a military dictatorship, a dictator of Nigeria in the past. And he's a Muslim, and he's very much pro-Western. I know that he, from information that I was given, that in actual fact he's in cahoots with Boko Haram at the same time as pretending to be their worst enemy. And of course, as we know, all over the world, there is a unipolar desire by the Western powers, particularly the US, Britain and Israel, to control the entire world for their benefit. And Nigeria is a country which is definitely in the sights of the Western powers.
This week in Yemen, the Americans have warned the Saudis that there could be some sort of retaliation. But I would just add, as a rider to that, it's almost as if the Yemenis have just got to suck it up. They're never allowed to retaliate.
Well, they have been retaliating. Do you remember they attacked the oil industry in Saudi Arabia with drones? They're able to chop because the army.
Occasionally, it's not really.
The army is split.
It's not on the same scale, though, is it?
Well, they've even been carrying out raids into Saudi Arabian territory. So the Saudis have basically lost the war in Yemen, but they're carrying on fighting because they don't know what else to do, creating the worst humanitarian catastrophe on the planet. And British military personnel are in Saudi Arabia, you know, the Islamists, the enemy, but except that they're our friends, and we are helping them to bomb the infrastructure of Yemen, which is killing thousands and thousands of innocent people. That's what we're doing.
And the most important, I suppose, in the region is always Israel and Palestine. And I spoke this week to a guy called Mike Farrar, who runs founder of a charity which helps people in and around Palestine. And it was quite fascinating to hear from him about how their charity got closed down and raided in Germany, where it's based. For example, Martin, armed police turning up at the charity's headquarters to smash the door down. Even though they've basically been treated as terrorists.
Well, that's because the German government is very much in the pocket of the Israeli state, much like lots of other establishment politicians elsewhere in the rest of the world.
Well, let's have a listen to Mike Farrar now, speaking to me earlier this week, talking about his experience really as trying to run a charity and then being raided by the anti-terrorist police in Germany and having their bank account closed down. I mean, effectively, this just means they cannot operate. They're just stopped from operating. But he talks here a little bit about some of the actual charitable work they do as well.
We're not wealthy. We're not a huge charity. I mean, we're talking small projects, maybe 5,000 here, 300 here, 500. We even tried to raise money for a journalist who was shot on the Great Return March with an explosive bullet and trying to save his leg, you know. Internationally banned explosive bullets. They were in that march, incidentally. They were shooting children. They were shooting women. They were shooting the disabled, murdering the disabled. The medics, that beautiful girl, Rosanne Hajar, the medic who was on Time magazine, who only wanted to be a medic, and journalists were being shot, doctors were being shot, the old and the young. And these were people hundreds of yards from the fence. And it's their land, and they're walking towards the fence, that's all. And the tear gassing, even the medic stations, well within hundreds of yards away from the apartheid fence.
You've got the accusation, isn't it, that you're supporting Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. In fact, the German government has declared it as a terrorist organization.
Yes, that's what they're saying. And
admittedly, they only said it was you were alleged to be supporting a terrorist organisation, but they raided you, I suppose, to see whether or not you were.
They certainly. If you, I could send you the press cuttings, and you'd see that we're guilty by press, basically. You know that. The reason they, and the fact is, we don't have anything to do with Hamas. That's the other side of it. As far as we can see, is all their evidence is taken off of Facebooker posts. So, for example, you might have a WWR organization next to another charity that is affiliated to the Muslim Brotherhood, who is also a charity, an Islamic charity. Now, we can't, if there's a photograph and our banner happens to get taken close to their banner and they're doing a project and we're doing a project, that doesn't mean to say that we're funding terrorism by any stretch of the imagination. I can tell you something.
What measures do you take to make sure that you're not?
Well, we go to extensive lengths to make sure that the people that we deal with working on the ground, and in fact, we've got a signed affidavit from the Palestinian Legal Authority, which is recognized by the international courts, where everybody has said that nobody has ever, nor would they, etc., that we have worked with, have anything to do with Hamas. And when Janine makes a contact, it's the first questions that they're asked, you know. But I mean, how much more due diligence can you do if you want to get money into a war-torn area? I don't know what you're expected to do.
Well, okay, so how was the raids on the 10th of April last year, 2019? How has it affected the charitable work?
It's completely, I mean, the real victims of all of this is that it's all come to a halt at exactly the same time as the Trump's decided to halt all aid to UNRWA. At exactly the same time, the steal of the century is being put through, deal of the century, I call it the steal of the century. It's all designed to put the Palestinians on their knees so that they'll accept a few tins of paint to redecorate their cells with, if you get my metaphor. It's a theft, it's a land grab, is what it is.
The social media companies haven't they been shutting down the Palestine websites?
They've been shutting them down left, right and centre. In fact, Claudia Marte, who runs the I Am the Face of 9/11 Truth Movement in America, had both his accounts shut down for absolutely no reason. That happened just the other day. The Palestinians, they're lucky if they stay up for any length of time at all, you know, just for speaking the truth. Really, what you've got to realize is the front line of the dystopian state we're heading, the classic example. By the way, that firm, Serco, I mentioned, they also run the FEMA camps, the federal emergency camps, where they tend to intern people who won't take the vaccines, etc. Really, if you want to see the jackboot consistently stamping on the face of humanity, well, it's happening before your very eyes. Well, because
I mean, look at in September 2016, Al Jazeera reports Facebook blocks accounts of Palestinian journalists, would you believe? In January 2017, Facebook closes accounts of Palestinian activists. That's the Middle East Monitor telling us about that. 2019, November last year, Twitter suspends accounts of the Palestinian Quds News network. Also in 2019, Facebook takes down pages of Palestinian news sites on a separate story. And then Facebook deactivates dozens of accounts of Palestinians at the request of the Israeli government. That was just May 2020. So this is obviously a bit of an epidemic of the social media companies caving into pressure from the Israel lobby, and maybe actually quite willingly doing so. It seems they've got a very close relationship. Anyway, very best of luck with your charitable work in the future.
Thanks. Well, there's also War on Want. They've been hit, and Halaby. He's in jail. He's with World Vision, and he's been tried 23 times, found not guilty, but they still won't let him out. That's World Vision, Halaby, and he's rotting in an Israeli dungeon as we speak, a Christian charity. And as I say, when you said to me, where is all this heading? Look what's happened in Palestine. It's the anvil of humanity. And they have been, in so many different ways, been used as a lab rat for new technologies, new weapon systems, all sorts of things. Even their organs are taken and used. I suspect Dick Cheney, who's had 3 heart transplants, he wouldn't surprise me if he's got a Palestinian one in there, because they're very strong-hearted people.
Okay. Mike Farah, thanks ever so much for your time.
It's a pleasure, and thank you, Tony, for spreading the truth. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Okay, so that's Mike Farah there. His charity's Worldwide Resistance Help EV, which is actually based in Germany, Martin. Now, I mean, there's an absolute assault on every way to do with the Palestinian people in Gaza. He's talking about there is basically a giant prison camp that when they get paint, that's just a... can paint their prison cells. The Israeli government, which we've been hearing much about, the whole Israel lobby to do with the Labour Party, it looks as if there is they've now got this thing called the nation state law, which is enshrining apartheid racism within the Israeli state. Now, I don't think this is what was originally intended in the Balfour Declaration, the First World War, is it?
Well, I think it's all implied in the Balfour Declaration. I mean, you can't basically say that people who've never lived in Palestine have got a right to go there and take over the local situation. I mean, that's the root of a lot of this conflict. And we've now got the Frankenstein's monster of the modern Israeli state created by the Balfour Declaration, which was basically because the British had conquered the area and they took it upon themselves to create.
Isn't there a bigger, a more horrific Dracula state in a way, which is the United States of America, also created by the British?
Well, indeed. I mean, although
I suppose you could say we didn't actually create Israel. It was the Israeli Jewish terrorists in the 1940s that created it.
Yeah, but the Balfour Declaration was the seed of all of this. And of course, it's ultimately, there is a question about whether that was right or not. And in actual fact, as I'm sure you're aware, many Palestinians would say that there was no right to create a Jewish state in what was historic Palestine. And the most of the arguments in favour of it are essentially specious.
Looking at the long-term history of colonisation, we're moving to it's 30th of October, the last of our Fridays where we're in Black History Month, and I get rather fed up with some of the what I would consider rather it's a bit like listening to fake rap or something. Here, I hope this is what you'll see is the real stuff to do with Black History, and this is a speech or part of a speech which I'll put the full version of up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as I will with the Mike Farah that you've just spoken to there. So if you're interested in finding more out about that, I'll make sure that that's available on our show page at thisweek.org.uk too. But Martin, Gaddafi was quite an important figure in Africa. He was trying to unite Africa, wasn't he, and actually say that Africa should, as a country. I mean, he was diametrically opposed to everything that the Western colonists in history and still want to achieve, which is the fragmentation, the balkanization of Africa, divide and rule, and have a whole load of proxy leaders, a bit like in Nigeria, a bit like the murder of Patrice Lumumba, and just literally, although they'll have black people running those countries, there'll be puppet governments in the future. That's it. But Gaddafi was the only one who really, to me, seemed to have the vision to really challenge that on an international stage.
Well, let's not get too carried away with Gaddafi. Gaddafi has got plenty of positive things that we could say about him, and no doubt we will say them. But, you know, at the end of the day, he wasn't really somebody who... Let's put it this way. He didn't come to power through democratic elections.
No, but it was a bloodless coup, actually.
Yes, it was, yes.
Yeah, so people forget this. I mean, he made sure that everybody that was going to be removed...
The removal of Gaddafi.
Everyone that was going to be removed from power, Idris and the rest of them, had a chance to just get on an aeroplane and fly out, and they weren't going to be killed, murdered or anything else. And that, some would say, was a mistake, because he should have made it absolutely clear that anyone that opposed him was going to be killed. Actually, what happened is he had a massive kind of Libyan organization in exile, but maybe that was... Well, what do you think? Do you think he should have got rid of those people, or should he have let them go?
I don't think it's an argument I want to enter into.
I'm not sure I do either.
Let's just say that the removal of Gaddafi was a scam by the Western powers. Whatever you could say about him, basically Libya was relatively stable, relatively prosperous. It had the highest standard of living in Africa, and most people were quite reasonably happy with what the situation was. Now it's a cauldron of civil war with outside forces supporting their various proxy militias.
But it was more than that
Libya.
Before, Martin,
and
wasn't it?
It's basically
it was an example.
It
was an example
case.
To the rest of Africa, actually, because they were doing things like the man-made river, this amazing project to bring fresh water. It was an incredibly advanced state. They had no debt with the IMF, and they were also proposing this currency to be separate to the International Monetary Fund as well. The standard of living, the child mortality rate were all skyrocketing really high, by far the highest in Africa, and in fact it's extremely good quality of life there, human rights and that sort of thing, in compared to many other countries in the world.
Yeah, it wasn't a paradise, but on the other hand, in material terms, it was in fact a success story.
And it wasn't.
Now it isn't.
Was it a dictatorship?
I think you've got to accept that it was, Tony. And that doesn't mean that the genuine achievements of the Gaddafi regime shouldn't also
be recognised.
But
Gaddafi did have a vision, didn't he? He was like what you would call a benevolent dictator. He had his green book, and he had all sorts of assemblies where people could actually get things changed. He didn't want to rule himself. He wanted to facilitate the rule by the people.
That was his shtick. But whether that was actually the case is another matter. Now, you know, I believe we're going to go on to discuss the dictatorship in China before the end of the programme. The point is that dictators can be relatively benevolent.
China
or relatively...
very different. Very, very different to Gaddafi. Anyway, can we just hear Gaddafi now? Because here he is, he talks about the colonisation of Africa in his UN speech on the 23rd of September 2009, 2 years before he died. A fascinating speech, which, I'll put a link up to the full speech on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
Regarding Africa, Mr. President, whether the United Nations is reformed or not, and even before a vote is taken on any proposals of a historic nature, Africa should be given a permanent seat on the Security Council now, having already waited too long. Leaving aside United Nations reform, we can certainly say that Africa was colonized, isolated, and persecuted, and its rights usurped. Its people were enslaved and treated like animals, and its territory was colonized and placed under trusteeship. The countries of the African Union deserve a permanent seat. This is a debt from the past that has to be paid and has nothing to do with the United Nations reform. It's a priority matter and is high on the agenda of the General Assembly. No one can say that the African Union does not deserve a permanent seat. Who can argue with that proposal? I challenge anyone to make a case against it. Where is the proof that an African Union or the African continent does not deserve a permanent seat? No one can possibly deny this. Another matter that should be voted on in the General Assembly is that of compensation for countries that were colonised so as to prevent the colonisation of a continent, the usurpation of its rights and the pillaging of its wealth from happening again. Why are Africans going to Europe? Why are the Asians going to Europe? Why are Latin Americans going to Europe? It is because Europe colonised those peoples and stole the material and human resources of Africa, Asia and Latin America, the oil, the minerals, the uranium, the gold, the diamonds, the fruit, the vegetables, the livestock and the people, and used them. Now new generations of Asians, Latin Americans and Africans are seeking to reclaim that stolen wealth, as they have the right to do so. At the Libyan border, I recently stopped 1,000 African migrants headed for Europe. I asked them, why were they going there? They told me it was to take back their stolen wealth, that they would not be leaving otherwise. Who can restore the wealth that was taken from us? If you decide to restore all this wealth, there will be no more immigration from the Philippines, Latin America, Mauritius, and India. Let us have the wealth that was stolen from us. Africa deserves $777 trillion in compensation from countries that colonized it. Africans will demand that amount. If you do not give it to them, they will go to where you have taken those trillions of dollars. They have the right to do so. They have to follow that money and bring it back again. Why is there no Libyan immigration to Italy, even though Libya is so close by? Italy owed compensation to the Libyan people. It accepted the fact and signed an agreement with Libya, which is adopted by both the Italian and the Libyan parliaments. Italy admitted that its colonization of Libya was wrong and should never be repeated, and promised not to attack the Libyan people by land, air or sea. Italy also agreed to provide Libya with $250 million a year in compensation over the next 20 years and to build a hospital for the Libyans maimed as a result of the mines planted in Libyan territory during the Second World War. Italy apologized and promised that it would never again occupy the territory of another country. Italy, which was a kingdom during the fascist regime, has made rich contributions to civilization, should be commended for this achievement, together with Prime Minister Berlusconi and his predecessor, who made their own contributions in that regard. Why is this third world demanding compensation? So there will be no more colonization. So that large and powerful countries will not colonize, knowing that they will have to pay compensation. Colonization should be punished. The countries that harmed other peoples during the colonial era should pay compensation for the damage and suffering inflicted under their colonial rule.
Well, you can see the kind of argument that's being made there. I don't think there's much hope of that happening. In actual fact, the reality is that countries which were colonised are still colonised today. And the poorest developing countries are now falling into a massive debt trap as a result of the crisis that we're in. And, you know, what should happen is that not just compensation is far, far away from happening, but there should definitely
well,
be.
Well, hang on, he's saying that the Italians are doing it.
No, the Italians had quite
well,
a,
were doing it
had quite a productive relationship with the Gaddafi regime, and they were very unhappy about the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime by the French, the British and the Americans. And of course, what the Italians will
can't
be
saying. Can we call it the Gaddafi government? Why do we have to call it the regime?
The Gaddafi government, or
we could call it the Tory regime and the Gaddafi government.
All right, well, the words obviously matter. But, of course, the Italians, who are now being overwhelmed by refugees and asylum seekers who are ending up in Italy, the obvious thing for them to say, well, it was the French and the British who overthrow the Gaddafi government, so you can take these refugees because we can't manage it. We actually oppose the intervention. You said, no, it'll be fine. We're going to overthrow Gaddafi. And we said, don't do that. The Italians were not happy with the intervention in Libya at all because they knew it would destabilize Libya and they would pay the price. And so it has transpired. And the obvious thing to say is that it's the British. Somebody should tell Nigel Farage, we were the ones who overthrew the regime, so we've got to take the refugees, which we said wouldn't happen, because it was going to be a democracy and everything was going to be fine. But of course it isn't, and it's not.
I always remember hearing about a British Royal Navy ship that was out over the in the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast, broadcasting lies and propaganda in order to deceive people in the country as to what the government was up to. And, you know, the whole point really here is using psychological warfare and broadcasting at the same time. It's just the same sort of thing as we're seeing in the controlling the narrative with the pandemic right now. But look, what about a bit more up to date and Malcolm X? I mean, okay, so Gaddafi died in 2011, 2 years after that speech. But, he was talking there about the colonial era. I'm much more interested in many ways in the way that the Black Power movement in the United States and in other places has been being controlled. Malcolm X was a big figure in that. Of course, he was assassinated, I think it was 1965, Martin. What was his role? Because we have here in Bristol, don't we, our good old Malcolm X Centre that was built in the 1980s.
Well, Malcolm X was a very outspoken activist. And ultimately, like many activists in the US, like Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, they ended up dead, murdered directly or indirectly by the deep state.
What about Malcolm X? What do you know about him? Was he assassinated by the government or by proxies or what?
There's bound to be questions about why, because we know that there were assassinated lots of people. Fred Hampton, for example, the Black Panther, who's murdered in Chicago as a young man. We know that the US state murders people. So it wouldn't be at all unlikely that they were their hand is to be found behind the murder of Malcolm X.
Well, Malcolm X was shot once in the chest with a sawn-off shotgun on the 21st of February 1965. Two other men then charged the stage where they were just about to have a rally with firing semi-automatic handguns. Really, he didn't stand a chance. But 2 days before that, he was warning anyone that would listen, including the media in the United States, that there was a plot to kill him. And I thought we'd have a listen now to that interview from Malcolm X, a press conference 2 days before he was assassinated, speaking about the various plots to kill him with the Nation of Islam and the Ku Klux Klan, it seems, working very closely together.
I know for a fact that there is a conspiracy between Muslims and the Lincoln Rockwell Nazi and also the Ku Klux Klan. There is a conspiracy.
Describe this conspiracy.
Well, the Ku Klux Klan made a deal, or were trying to make a deal, with Elijah Muhammad in 1960 in the home of Jeremiah X, the minister in Atlanta at that time, who was president as the minister in Philadelphia. They were trying to make a deal with him to make available to Elijah Muhammad a county, a size tract of land in Georgia or South Carolina, where Elijah Muhammad could then induce Negroes to migrate and make it appear that his program of a segregated state or separated state was feasible. And to what extent these negotiations finally developed, I do not know, because I was not involved in them beyond the period of December 1960. But I do know that after that, Jeremiah, who was the minister throughout the South, could roam the entire South, and the Klan not bother him in any way, shape, or form, nor would they bother any of the black Muslims from then on, nor would the black Muslims bother the Klan.
Are you inferring, then, that because of this conspiracy, the attempt was made upon your life?
Ask that again.
Are you inferring that because of this conspiracy, the attempt was made on your life?
Not necessarily that conspiracy. The attempt was made upon my life because I speak my mind and I know too much, and they know that I will speak it whether they like it or not. Pardon me?
Are you urging your followers to take any actions against the Muslims?
Am I urging my followers to take action against the Muslims? No.
Did you try to infiltrate their organization and win over some of their supporters?
Am I going to try and infiltrate their organization and win over some of their supporters? No, I have never tried to win supporters from Elijah Muhammad. Since I have left the Black Muslim movement, I've spoken at these rallies. Those who come, come. Those who don't, don't. But I've never gone out of my way to win over any of his followers. And he himself is fearful because he knows that you don't have to exercise too much energy to win his followers. As soon as they know truth and compare the two, and by the way, this is the brother, this is, I didn't see you there, brother. This is Leon Amir, who was Cassius Clay's secretary, whom they beat unmercifully up in Boston. And the court freed the men who beat him. They fined him $100, was it?
Yeah, $100.
Fined him $100. And he was on the inside of the Black Muslim specialty squad. And I know it. And it was he who heard Elijah Muhammad Jr. come to New York when Elijah Muhammad was at the Armory in June of last year. Jr. stood up and told the fruit, many of whom are here now also, that I should have been killed, that my tongue should have been put in an envelope and sent back to Chicago by now. And because Fat Joseph had not done it, they demoted him. He remained captain, but Clarence up in Boston was put over Joseph. And Joseph's authority was curtailed. And then Clarence, the captain from Boston, and John, the captain from Springfield, came to New York to assassinate me and came to him to get a silencer and couldn't get it. So the police know this. It's not something that's new. They just wait until the job is done and then they step in.
They wait until the job is done. That being the assassination of Malcolm X, and then they step in, Martin. Malcolm X speaking just 2 days before he was assassinated. One of the fascinating things he's talking about there, Martin, is the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad. He split from them a good while before that. I think it was 1961, so that's, 4 years before. The interesting thing about they certainly weren't traditional Muslims, Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam. And they had these pro-separation views, which many have pointed out were exactly actually the same as the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, we know that the intelligence services in the West create counter-gangs. In other words, they create their own opposition, which they can then manipulate. And it's controlled opposition, and I'm fairly confident that Martin Luther King, which I know a little bit more about, there's been a civil court case which has basically concluded that he was definitely murdered by the state, and that the man who's in prison for doing it, James Earl Ray, the family of Martin Luther King are convinced that he's innocent, and he claims that he's innocent. And
there's quite a lot of things like this, aren't there? Like the mother of PC Yvonne Fletcher, who was shot in London supposedly by the Libyans, Queenie, doesn't believe that the Libyans did it.
Well, that's because they didn't do it. But what you've got to recognise is that a lot of terrorism, sometimes you do get random terrorism. Somebody who's, for whatever reason, has worked themselves up into a frenzy and carries out some dreadful act. But an awful lot of it, and especially the more sophisticated things like 9/11, are clearly run by intelligence services. They always have been. And there's nothing new about this.
He's been doing it for years. Malcolm X is criticising Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad there. And he's quite right, I think, to do so. Elijah Muhammad established something called Temple Farms as a base for his people. Then it was changed to New Muhammad Farms on a Ku Klux Klan 5,000-acre tract of land in Terrell County, Georgia, that the George Lincoln Rockwell, the founder of the American Nazi Party, he once called Elijah Muhammad the Hitler of the black man. So it's almost as if these organisations were deliberate attempts to sort of get whites and blacks in some sort of race war going. There's quite a few examples of that. But what do you think is going on today? Is it a similar thing or is it different?
It's the same patterns going back decades. The deep state in the US, heavily infiltrated by the Israelis and cooperating with the British deep state, have been running terrorism, left-wing terrorism, right-wing terrorism, Islamist terrorism, for years. years and years, the evidence is overwhelming that most of this stuff is actually orchestrated from inside state structures. And nothing has changed. The same things go on. We're moving now to a collapse of global capitalist regime, and the powers that be behind the scenes are preparing, what they regard as a massive power play, the Faustian bid for world dominance. But unluckily for them, there's plenty of opposition in the form of other forces at work, which are going to make it very difficult for them to achieve their goal.
As we head for Halloween tomorrow, we have these weekends are starting to become a little bit nail-biting affairs sometimes, especially when you're getting nerves from the stock markets and that sort of thing. Isn't it most likely that if there is any sort of 1929-level style of collapse, which will then, of course, put everybody right on track for the Great Reset, and the World Economic Forum will say, it's okay, everyone, come into our open arms, that would happen over a weekend? It's sort of on a Friday night, things are announced, and by the Monday morning, the stock exchanges reopen, and then all the money disappears.
Well, I think some fairly catastrophic market event is definitely on the cards.
What would you see as the most likely way that would play out?
It's hard to say, because don't forget that the deep state that are behind all of this, they will choose their moment that suits them. Even if they don't choose the moment, if they try and just keep printing money and keep the whole show on the road, eventually there will be some kind of small maneuver which will pull the whole thing down. It'll be some derivatives contract held by Deutsche Bank will go sour, and from there everything will collapse very quickly.
Let's be frank and honest here. They can actually make this whole thing, House of Cards, fall down any weekend they want, can't they?
Yeah, well, there's one of the things that may cause the problem is that there's no stimulus measures been agreed in because of the election. The Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the Congress and Trump in the White House are unwilling to agree with each other to do what's necessary to keep the show on the road in terms of a stimulus program. That may lead the algos that run the markets to panic, and a crash either just before or immediately after November the 3rd next week, when the election takes place, is a definite possibility.
Also, I think it's every once in a while it's a good idea to mention the good old Microsoft Halloween memos. The Halloween documents, according to Wikipedia, comprise a series of confidential Microsoft memoranda on potential strategies relating to free software, open source software, and Linux in particular. A series of media responses to these memoranda, both of the leaked documents and the responses, were published by Eric S. Raymond in 1998. But Martin, this Halloween memo is pretty chilling stuff, actually.
Well, you'd have to tell me what it is, because I'm not aware.
Well, the idea is that to all sorts of underhand measures in order to stop the open source community.
Yeah,
because Microsoft realised in 1998 that if open source was allowed to flourish, Microsoft could be dead within years.
Yeah, and also I've been reading recently, WikiLeaks. Something, chapter 7, I think it is. All of the different.
Vault 7, maybe?
Yeah, it's all of the different techniques that have been developed by GCHQ, the NSA, the CIA, to basically sabotage, their rivals, that are operating in the high tech area. So they've got all sorts of, there's a whole list of different tools which they've developed which can, target their various targets that they have.
This is not cricket, is it? The idea is here that it's a sort of hostile attack on any of your competition. You get the machine gun out, you identify your competition, and you destroy it.
Yeah, because that's what competition, unless you've got rules, it's not really a competition, it's just a war, isn't it?
Things like the document revealed, this is the Halloween document one, revealed that they come up with this little term FUD, F-U-D, spreading fear, uncertainty and doubt, was a traditional marketing strategy from Microsoft, acknowledged and understood internally. So this is the FUD tactics, for example, announcing non-existent products or spreading rumours that competing products will crash windows. These sorts of lies actually help you in your marketing strategy. Now, this is the sorts of things that Microsoft realized in order to stop people collaborating and developing their own free and open source software that they were going to have to do.
Yeah. We haven't got to China yet, but of course the Red Hat Chinese internal internet is based on Linux, because they, and of course the German intelligence services will not use Windows.
So is there any free speech on it?
No, they've got, what they're doing is...
No, it's not used for free speech. No, it's more for surveillance, really.
Well, what we're talking about is there is a contest between different forces at work.
They certainly don't want to use Microsoft, and I can understand why. I mean, that's the whole point, is to get people hooked on that stuff. Anyway, so let's have a listen to our final item now, unless you want to talk any more about China. I mean, I just mentioned at the top of the hour, there's all sorts of problems over there, but the social credit system. I mean, I'd say just one thing about it is it looks to me as if the sorts of measures that are being brought in here with COVID are starting to put us in line with China. So you've got to do this and do that, and you're told where you can and can't go. This is an authoritarian system they're trying to bring in Britain and in Europe and in America and in the Western world generally, because they've seen how well it can work in China at controlling the population like sheep.
Well, there is basically contest between different power centres. The Western power centres, we've been discussing them, the assassination of Gaddafi, the assassination of Malcolm X, etc. The Chinese have got their own list of bad behaviour, but they're not the same as the West. They've got a different agenda. And that, of course, is the problem for the capitalists in the West, is that the Chinese communists have turned out to be rather effective at capitalism and warfare. And of course, the Russian military have got them by the short and curlies.
The big difference, of course, is that the Chinese system it doesn't allow free speech, whereas ours just about still does. But we've got a system here of massive surveillance too, which with actually almost the flick of a switch, and that flick of that switch could be to do with fake pandemics or whatever. They can turn their surveillance system into a real live one, like there is in China.
Well, there is a competition to develop systems which are effective at controlling resources and people. And, you know, there isn't just one source of that. There's competing power centres. And, you know, they've got different techniques. You don't see much false flag terrorism in China, because that doesn't really work. That's not how their system works. You see loads of it in the West. So we get freedom of speech, but we get blown up on trains and buses. They don't get freedom of speech, but they don't do stuff like that because they don't need to. They just basically have got better control of the population by the methods that they've already traditionally used.
Simon Dolan, the solicitor, has been doing a court case against the... And I had some notes here saying, let's find out what happened. Apparently, there was going to be some sort of resolution to that today. I've just been searching for it, can't find anything. That doesn't mean to say nothing's happened. It just means to say the search engines are stopping me finding it. But we'll finish this week with David Livingston and his look at the Kabbalah. A reason I think this is fascinating is that we've got this whole idea of man-God. The idea that man can be God is actually quite a worry. What do you make of that, Martin? Because there were a lot of people at the time that said that this was a kind of Hitler figure, the idea that everyone had to kind of worship the guy and get behind him, and that being actually a Kabbalistic thing.
Worship which guy?
Adolf Hitler.
Oh, Hitler's people had interest in occult matters. No doubt about it. But the idea that humans can be gods, well, there's plenty of that out there. It's a part of Sufism, for example, in Islam.
Well, that's interesting, because David Livingston would say that that is part of the dodgy side of Islam, which was created deliberately by the British Empire, the idea to create
Sufism,
fake versions of these various faiths in order to discredit them.
Well, I've just been reading a book about the history of Islam. Sufism was well established.
Not David Livingston.
Well established long before the British Empire. So, you know, that doesn't really stack up. I mean, what you've got, basically, if we're going to get into these rather abstract and abstruse areas, is, you know, human civilization is very complicated, and there's all sorts of linkages and different ideas from different times and periods, which, you know...
Are you going to say anything here?
Well, no,
because
I've
listened to David Livingstone.
You know, because there's just so much to say, isn't there?
Okay, let's have a listen to David Livingstone, where he talks about, well, you know, his understanding of Kabbalah in an interview that I did with him last week. And I'll put that up on our show page, a full version at thisweek.org.uk.
The Kabbalah is founded on the belief that man can become God. That's their goal, right? To become, they don't believe God as an external power entity that has power over us. They believe that man can and will become God. And that's what they're trying to create. That their vehicle is the personal computer and artificial intelligence. So when you see how it's being used, you know, now that they have this full control, not only of our data, but basically of the information that we're supplied, basically our, how we interpret the world, that you can see that they have, because, you know, I was thinking as I said, we started our conversations that I remember when the internet first came out, I heard that there had been comparisons to radio, when radio first came out. And there was this big hoopla, big optimism when the radio came out that it was going to liberate the masses and be a democratic medium that was going to allow people to, broadcast anyone to broadcast their information. What happened is that eventually it was consolidated and then ultimately controlled. And I think most of us were enthusiastic and hopeful about the prospects of the internet, but I fear that we are witnessing the monopolization of the internet. So we're getting to the point now where you, as it was in TV before and radio before, that you've got a handful of big players that are now able to control, and they're effectively censoring dissent.
Okay, so that's David Livingstone there, the author of Auto Ab Keo, speaking to me last week, and I put a link up to the full interview with David on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, these are ideas about the Kabbalah, etc. Do you think we are anti-Semitic to be discussing it in this way?
I don't see what anti-Semitism's got to do with it. I mean, I think that the comments he made about the internet are pretty obvious, and comparing it to radio. The Kabbalah, on the other hand, is a rather more esoteric kind of point. And, there's been lots of people have had lots of esoteric ideas over the years, many of them incompatible. So one set of esoteric ideas is different from another set of esoteric ideas. And I think my fundamental objection to Livingstone is he puts all these esoteric ideas in one box and says that they're all linked. And in actual fact, there are lots of different kinds of esoteric ideas.
Well, I can tell you, he does some pretty damn good full references to everything he's doing.
Yeah.
Thanks to Martin Summers there, Irish Republican Labour activist and studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s. You can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. And if you've written to BCFM asking for our show to be reinstated, please do put a copy of that email or letter up on our show page at the contact page, where you'll also find links to contact the Bristol Community Manager and also the chair of the board of BCFM. Now, I am shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. This show's rebroadcast 9 o'clock and midnight Friday, apparently, on the BCFM stream here, and over Sunday lunch in two places, noon at richieallen.co.uk and radioquk.com. Do feel free to download and rebroadcast this show complete anywhere you like. I just request you credit the show to thisweek.org.uk. And if you'd like to write to BCFM boss Pat Hart requesting a reinstatement, the links are on the contact tab at our show page. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Charlie down. It was in the jungle wars of 65. My weapon jammed and I got stuck way out and all alone. And I could hear the enemy moving in close outside. Just then I heard a twig snap and I grabbed my empty gun. And I dug in scared while I counted down my fate. And then a big marine, a giant with a pair of friendly eyes, appeared there at my shoulder and said, wait. When he came in close beside me, said, don't worry, son, I'm here. If Charlie wants to tangle now, he'll have two to dodge. I said, well, thanks a lot. I told him my name and asked him his. And he said, the boys just call me Camouflage. Side by side we took our battle stance, and I wondered how the bullets missed this man. Cause they seemed to go right through him, just as if he wasn't there. And the morning we both took a chance and ran. And it was near the riverbank when the ambush came on top of us. And I thought it was the end and we were had. Then a bullet with my name on it came buzzing through a bush, and that big marine, he just swatted with his hand, just like it was a fly. Whoa, camouflage, things are never quite the way. Something weird about him, cause when I turned around, he was pulling a big palm tree right up out of the ground and swatting those Charlies with it from here to kingdom come. When he led me out of danger, I saw my camp and waved goodbye. He just winked at me from the jungle and then was gone. And when I got back to my HQ, I told him about my night, the battle I'd spent with a big marine named Camouflage. When I said his name, a soldier gulped and a medic took my arm and led me to a green tent on the right. He said, you may be telling true, boy, but this here is Camouflage, and he's been right here since he passed away last night. In fact, he's been here all week long. But before he went, he said, Semper Fi, and said his only wish was to save a young marine caught in a barrage. So here, take his dog tag, son. I know he wants you to have it now.